Majority Report with Sam Cedar, where every day's casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday, Tuesday, casual Tuesday, Wednesday, casual hump day, Thursday, casual Thurs, that's what we call it, and Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Friday, December 20th, 2019. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, it's the final casual Friday of 2019, and arguably the decade, although that argument would be wrong. We will get into that. Probably we'll spend the whole show talking about that.
It's great.
Joining us on the program, Heather Parton, or as you may know her, Digby, from the blog Hullabaloo and Salon.com. Also on the program today, from his eBay account and from the
forcing senior citizens to watch terrifying dystopian movies about incest that are really about capitalism.
A Queens-based JCC,
right.
Learning Annex. I can't remember where it's located.
He made
exactly.
us watch this Dutch film about a brother and sister.
But with a very prestigious announcement about the film he's been working on.
Fantastic.
Matthew Film Guy.
Finally.
Will be with us. Also on the program, wrap up of the Democratic debate. Everyone sees Buttigieg's reflection on the wine cave wall. I hope you know your Nietzsche and your Plato.
Plato.
Well, so I know Plato. It from Thus Spake Zarathustra. So it's...
Dad, I'm reading friggin' Zarathustra.
I know it from the cask of Amontillado.
Easy for Zarathustra to say.
Yeah,
exactly. Meanwhile, Trump reportedly told aides that he knows it was Ukraine that interfered in the 2016 election because his best bud, Booty Poot, told him so. It's being reported. Mick Mulvaney reportedly flying the coop. Is it possible Mark Meadows really wants that job? And the House and Senate pass a $1.4 trillion spending bill averting a shutdown. And congrats, it's full of huge giveaways to the medical industry and pharmaceutical industry, including the one that the lawmakers were so proud of stripping from the U.S., the new NAFTA program. I can't say it.
Get it while you can.
Meanwhile, SCOTUS will hear two cases on whether religious organizations will have broad ability to ignore civil rights laws in terms of their employees. Congress passes a 401k reform, non-reform, that will make brokers richer and puts lie to the complaints about college debt forgiveness. New Georgia temporary senator vows to fight the impeachment sham, though it's unclear which part of the impeachment she believes is a sham.
The sham part.
Virginia Zoo shows how Trump's degraded USDA, or how degraded Trump's USDA has become. And lastly, Trump battles new sanctions on Russia because all this and more on today's program, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you so much for joining us on what is the final live program of 2019. Although I will be hopping on YouTube on and off during the vacation And I will also will be doing the AM Quickie, although it may be a slightly varied version of it. I think we may do it a little more casually, may record it through the phone, may do it while I'm making eggs. I'm not sure what's going to happen.
Don't tempt them.
What's that?
Don't tease them.
Don't, yes.
People want to watch you making eggs. So
well,
bad.
No, that will not be, the AM Quickie is just audio only.
Yeah, you'll just be able to hear the sizzle.
That's right. You'll just be able to, or the scramble, whatever it's going to be, or maybe the boil. Who knows?
Some real ASMR.
Exactly. You can sign up for the AM Quickie, which we would encourage you to do. It is completely free. It is simply a podcast subscription. And you can do that through amquickie.com. You can do it on Stitcher. You can do it on, I don't know if it's on Spotify. That's a good question. You can do it on iTunes. We should look into that. But certainly you can go subscribe to it there. Or you can just pick up the Majority Report app and find it on the app if you want. But it's always good to subscribe to both programs, both free versions of the free version of the Majority Report and the AM Quickie through a, you know, iTunes or something like that, even if you tend to listen to it on the app, because it helps our numbers and brings in new people, et cetera, et cetera. And just a reminder at the end of the year, that it's your support that has made this show possible, not just for this year, and I want to say the decade, but in fact, it's only been 9 years of the decade. In fact, really, it will be the decade when this show has its 10th anniversary, because we all know that the world did not start, or our calendar did not start in the year zero, started in the year one. Of the common era, as we like to say.
Sounds
when
a little
we're
bit
Jewish.
Of Ben Shapiro energy.
What?
Yeah. I don't know. I just, the real precision about these dates.
Yeah. I think tell it to Stephen Jay Gould.
Time is social.
Oh, you know what? You're right. All right. All right. I take it back. Stephen Jay Gould.
Oh, Stephen Jay Gould said
Stephen,
it must
yes,
be right.
Exactly.
Right. Okay.
It, precisely. I'm conceding fully the point.
I actually think it deserves an apology. Not to me.
I apologize
but to
the,
Stephen Jay
to
Gould
the,
for comparing.
The memory of Stephen Jay Gould.
I am so... well,
anyway.
Actually, a lot of people.
I'm
Stephen
with
Jaden
Smith. Time's not real.
The point, regardless of all the questions about time, this show exists because of your support. And you, I want to thank those of you who become members. Encourage those of you who enjoy this show and think you're going to enjoy it in 2020, which should be a real crap show of a year, as
it
were.
It's going to be a real humdinger.
Oh, my God. Join themajoritycom. Join themajoritycom. There you can go. Check it out. Become a member. All right. We're going to be doing some debate roundup today when we have Digby on. I mean, theoretically, we could look back on the decade. The problem is that I don't think that we could even look back on the last 3 weeks sufficiently. So we're not going to do the traditional year-end review thing. I think maybe in January, I'm going to have Perrine come on. Maybe we'll look back on stuff. I think that's the way we did it last year, actually, now that I think about it, or something to that effect. And I think that's much more effective, because you get so many of the look back on stuff. And really, the first week of January is really the time where you should look back on stuff.
Well, that way you can review the reviews of the decade, too.
You can review the reviews of the decade, and it's also, you don't have that thing like, well, how come nobody ever talks about, like, the 31st? That always gets lost. Or the 30th, the 29th. Nobody talks about those days, because everybody's done the review of the year.
It's deep, dude.
We also have some great, great best ofs. In fact, you might say they're the best of 2019 that we've compiled for you under the auspices of our best of shows. Over the next week and a half. Some stuff is funny. A lot of the stuff is super interesting. Some of it's really just cracked dry. That dry. I mean, like, just cracked earth dry. Right? But, no, yeah, I think you'll enjoy. All right, let's get to... it's hard to say what the biggest takeaway of the debate was last night, because I think, frankly, there was a couple. I have a feeling that you know, you generally get those debates where it's like one person pops and nothing else happens. But I have a feeling like there's a bunch of people going a bunch of different directions after this. And I think our quick response analysis more or less was correct last night. But I get this, having spent the night to marinate it, I'm feeling like Pete Buttigieg might have taken a much more of a beating than I think even we thought that he had last night, even though that we did. And it came at the hands of a couple of different people. But I think the worst one might be from Amy Klobuchar because of the nature of it, which was striking at not just his electability, but really like how are you, what are you doing up on this stage, dude? Like, because let's remember, he has completely abandoned his interesting proposal on court packing. Not just the proposal was interesting, but the impetus to do it signified to people like, this is a guy who's not going to be constrained by, you know, tradition and norms and understands that we're in the midst of a knife fight. And he's willing to bring, you know, a knife to a knife fight or a gun, whatever. But he's completely abandoned that. And remember, part of the interest in this guy at the beginning was he's for Medicare for all. And so he was bringing new ideas to the fore. But he abandoned all those things and basically became a young version of Joe Biden. I can bring the country together. I am electable because of where I've been, and I'm young. So I have all the things that you love about Joe Biden with a lot less specificity, no experience, but youth. And that's important because, you know, young people are younger than older people. So, but Amy Klobuchar basically decided to go right at him, basically on the topic of A, you're not electable, and B, you haven't done really much.
You had your hand up.
Well, I was hearkening back. I made my case on immigration to what the mayor said about Washington. So I look at this a different way. When we were in the last debate, Mayor, you basically mocked the 100 years of experience on the stage. And what do I see on this stage? I see Elizabeth's work starting the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau and helping 29 million people. I see the vice president's work in getting $2 billion for his cancer moonshot. I see Senator Sanders' work of working to get the veterans bill passed across the aisle. And I see what I've done, which is to negotiate 3 farm bills and be someone that actually had major provisions put in those bills. So while you can dismiss committee hearings, I think this experience works. And I have not denigrated your experience as a local official. I have been one. You know, I just think you should respect our experience when you look at how you evaluate someone who can get things done.
Thank you, Senator. Mr. Mayor, I'll give
now
you
pause it for 1 second. Here's the thing that, and I don't think most voters pick up on this, but. I do on some level. I have a background in theater. Buttigieg has a tell that he's about to go. Whenever he's cornered on anything, he's going to go right to his military service and make it about putting his life on the line. Remember now, all that Klobuchar has done now is maybe there's a slight little denigration in terms of like, you've just done local stuff, but we've done stuff that have helped millions of people. That's her pitch. Watch how defensive he gets as if his service is being attacked.
Can I just say, I thought this was bad while I was watching it.
It's worse.
An order of magnitude worse rewatching it.
You actually did denigrate my experience, Senator, and it was before the break, and I was going to let it go because we got bigger fish to fry here, but... You implied
I don't
that
think we
have
bigger fish to fry than picking a president of the United States.
You're right.
That's good again.
Savage.
And before the break, you seemed to imply that my relationship to the First Amendment was a talking point, as if anyone up here has any more or less commitment to the Constitution than anybody else up here. Let me tell you about my relationship to the First Amendment. It is part of the Constitution that I raised my right hand and swore to defend with my life. That is my experience, and it may not be the same as yours, but it counts, Senator. It counts.
Thank you,
Mr. Mayor. Senator Klobuchar, you have 45 seconds to respond.
I certainly respect your military experience. That's not what this is about. This is about choosing a president. And I know my view of this is I know you ran for to be chair of the Democratic National Committee. That's not something that I wanted to do. I want to be president of the United States. And the point is we should have someone heading up this ticket that has actually won and been able to show that they can gather the support that you talk about of moderate Republicans and independents, as well as a fired up Democratic base. And not just done it once. I have done it 3 times. I think winning matters. I think a track record of getting things done matters. And I also think showing our party that we can actually bring people with us, have a wider tent, have a bigger coalition, and yes, longer coattails, that matters.
Thank you, Senator.
Denise. I got to respond to that. No. Senator, I know that if you just go by vote totals, maybe what goes on in my city seems small to you. If you want to talk about the capacity to win, try putting together a coalition to bring you back to office with 80% of the vote as a gay dude in Mike Pence's Indiana.
Pause it for 1 second. Just to be clear, he got 8,500 votes. So he put together this coalition and got 80% of the vote. Presumably the whole vote was about, 10,500?
In a liberal college town.
But he stitched together a coalition of 8,500 people. Now,
Tech incubators. There were racist cops. Some of my parents' friends in the faculty community. I stitched that coalition together.
I want to say this, that I understand what a monumental achievement that is. Because when I ran for student government president, and when I ran as treasurer of the senior year class at Doherty Memorial High School in Worcester, I had to stitch together a coalition of people that brought me about 90% of the votes, which was close to 1,300 votes. And now that's no 8,500 votes, but I get the dynamic.
I think without campaigning, every single one of us in this room have gotten, along with several Cumtown cast members, a multitude of write-in votes for local offices
in
Brooklyn.
That's true.
And we've pulled that coalition together without even actively campaigning.
That's true. But there's a reason why he says 80% of the vote as opposed to 8,500 votes. 8,500 votes, ladies and gentlemen. There's almost that many people in attendance at this Democratic debate. But here is where Klobuchar says, you know what? If you're going to put that out there, guess what I'm going to do?
To bring you back to office with 80% of the vote as a gay dude in Mike Pence's Indiana.
Pence had 40% approval rating, incidentally. But whatever.
If you had won in Indiana, that would be one thing. You tried and you lost by 20 points.
Did you read the fact check on that?
Yes, there is a fact check on that. She is referring to his statewide treasury run, and she got that wrong, to be fair. He lost by 27% of the vote. He lost to a guy named Richard Murdoch. And think about this. When he talks about how great it was that he was able to win in South Bend in Mike Pence's Indiana, the reality is that not only did Richard Murdoch beat him by 27%, but after serving, this is in 2010, after serving as a treasurer for 2 years, Murdoch decided to run against Joe Donnelly in 2012 and lost by 6%. So there's no perfect way to measure this, but Pete Buttigieg is so far away from winning a statewide office. And it wasn't just because he was a Democrat. Joe Donnelly beat the guy who beat Buttigieg by 27%, beat him by 6% after that guy had been in state office for 2 years. So
the
Buttigieg,
whole brand is fraudulent. I mean, I'm sorry, I just want to say, look, I don't really care on some level. If he was still running on court packing and so on, and he was just a mayor, then I would, great, you know, whatever. Like, there's a limit to how much I want to beat up on him for just being a small town mayor. However, his book, his pack, his language is this, like, I have a special connection with the Midwest electorate. And the only reason he's doing this delusional run is because he cannot win statewide in Indiana.
That is the point I was trying to make it at the top, was like, all he has left is this electability argument. And the thing is it like, look, I didn't know the specifics of this. And I'm quite convinced that if I didn't know the specifics of this, most of the people in the press did not know the specifics of it. And I can assure you that today they all know. And so when Pete Buttigieg tries to make this claim, and that's why I think this is one of those instances where the debate was particularly painful and going to be hard for him. I think other people may have shifted up and down. We can talk about that more with Digby. But I think Pete Buttigieg, if Pete Buttigieg starts to drop, I think now, anyways, this is that moment, and this debate will have been the moment that Pete Buttigieg went away.
And good for Amy Klobuchar. Yeah. Like, I can see how he would be legitimately annoying to her, because she is, to some degree, a self-made woman. As I understand it, she had kind of a difficult childhood growing up with an alcoholic for a dad. And she's very honest about what she believes. And, you know, I don't agree with the things she believes, but she's honest. And then she sees this little twerp coming in, like, saying he's for Medicare for all, pivoting left and right. Like, it's time for her to spank him like his mama never did.
I had a conversation
like she does to her staff.
I had a conversation with, off the record conversation, with a candidate who dropped out of the race. There's a lot of them, so it's not, I'm not going to say who it is, and you won't know. And they said, the one thing they said is that he believes nothing. At least that's the thinking of the other candidates, that Pete Buttigieg believes in nothing. And I think that's coming out. And I think that's a good thing, frankly. I'm happy to see that. Where am I? Okay. Oh, before we go to Digby. Oh, I should tell you this. All right. Look, you've spent a lot of money to make your home beautiful. Maybe you haven't spent a lot of money to make your home beautiful, but you don't want to let it go to waste without good lighting. And frankly, you can get away with not spending a lot of money on your apartment with good lighting. In other words, you don't have to have the greatest furniture, but lighting creates the sense of the space. Bottom line. Lamps Plus has been helping customers love their everyday spaces for over 40 years. They got chandeliers, they got ceiling lights, they got table lamps, they got more. The light itself is like jewelry for the home. I mean, frankly, I don't think it's just an accoutrement. Lamps Plus is the nation's largest lighting retailer. Has over 55,000 designs from top brands and their own exclusive designs in lighting, home furnishing, and decor. You don't have to guess at what the designs are going to look like. You don't have to wander around a big box store. Lamp Plus has videos with design tips and all the photos on their site to tell you which light fixtures or furniture pieces are featured. It's easy to buy what you like. They also have a large selection of Minka Leveri lights, lighting, which transforms your home into like wonderful living spaces. Minka Leveri is known for designs that blend function and style using innovative materials. I got a very sort of like sleek, you know, my whole style is I like it functional and I like it clean, clean lines. That's the way I go for it. Mid-century modern type of look, that's where I'm at. But I'm also a very functional person. I don't know if people have come, I don't think that,
what
that comes across.
What sense are you using the word functional?
I mean, for me, functionality, that's a good point. Functionality is very important to me. Functionality is very important, right? Like I set up my whole, you know, I get everything is within my arm's reach at any given point. I got a lamp, has a USB plug and a regular outlet on it, but it's discreet. You can't really see it until you plug it in. It's a perfect, I could use it as a bedside lamp, or I could use it as a table lamp. I happen to use it as a nightlight type of thing. Right now, you can get up to 50% off of hundreds of lights, furniture, and decor between November 25th and December 24th. We're right in the heart of that. That's up to 50% off during Lamps Plus holiday sale. November 25th through December 24th. Go to Lamps Plus, LAMPSPLUS.com/majority to start saving today. That's LAMPSPLUS.com/majority. Quick break. Be back with Digby. We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report. Ladies and gentlemen, it is always a pleasure to welcome to the program the person that inspired this, I would call it jingle, maybe.
Are you ready for some pee-pee?
Wait a second. I don't remember that part of it.
I don't either. I did not register that.
I had been playing a shorter one, but I found a longer one.
Oh my gosh. There you go. Wow. That's great. It's about time. Ladies and gentlemen.
This song invented chill wave.
Well, I was going to say, Heather Parton, Digby, welcome to the program. That song is so chill that it almost feels not of this era or even remotely appropriate.
Neither am I, so that's it.
I guess there could be some people who are appropriate to this era, but it really just seems like, and I'm obviously getting a little bit reflective because we're at the end of the year. We're arguably at the end of the decade. Many people will mistakenly assume that we are, and so we have to play along. Really ends at the end of 2021, but 2020, but nevertheless. Let's just spend 2 minutes talking about the past 10 years. Nuts, sure. Right? Nuts.
Crazy. And, I've been through some crazy decades, and this one really takes the cake. And it seems like it's both rushed by, it seems like it was yesterday that it was, 2009, But at the same time, there has been so much that has happened that it also feels like, you know, it's been 50 years instead of 10. It's been amazing. And I was thinking about this last night. And, you know, I mean, the beginning of this decade was Occupy Wall Street.
Yeah.
Can you believe that?
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, and reflecting on that, I think that really this decade, trying to see, you know, think about what really happened. And it's tempting to talk about Trump and, you know, all that. And, of course, that was, you know, to me, that was just the natural evolution of where the Republican Party had been going for a long time. But the rise of the left, I think, has been unremarked upon as this decade, as, you know, maybe the most important part of this decade. I mean, we know the rise of the right. We've, you know, talked about it ad nauseum. But when Occupy Wall Street started, it started in 2010 in September. And I think it kind of, you know, I think it will be looked back upon as a watershed moment. Obviously we'd all been talking about that stuff for years, and, you know, the left had been building itself in small increments, but that really, really burst it into a new level, I think, of awareness. And it's why we, you know, now see, like, on the presidential debate stage, two, you know, left-wing candidates who are doing very well. One of them may end up being president. And you see a left that is far more influential, and you see the ideas that undergirded all that becoming much, much more mainstream. And, you know, this stuff does take time. So 10 years, that seems, I mean, I'm sorry to, you know, tell all you young folks that it takes that kind of time, but sadly it does. But that's why, you know, you keep at it. And, you know, here we are 10 years later, and a lot of what they were talking about in the street in Zuccotti Park are on the mainstream stage with Democratic candidates debating about it. So,
I think that's so spot on. And I do think that we're not going to hear much about that, but that is really the story of this decade. Donald Trump is a culmination of stuff that existed back in 2008, without a doubt, you know, it was the culmination of the conservative movement. You and I have been talking about that in the aughts quite a bit. And, I distinctly remember there are two moments where I distinctly remember that give me a sense of like where, of what my sense was as to where things were around that time. When Current, the Al Gore network launched. Okay. As a left network, when Olbermann left MSNBC and went over to Current, and I don't think it had quite launched yet. They were meeting, and I remember meeting with the dude who was running it, some idiot from CNN. I mean, just like sort of like, I think he was the one who like developed the hologram or something like that. But I remember sitting in his office. This must have been about 2009, 2008. And I said, you know, I think the big argument that's going to happen now is outside versus the inside. The people who are agitating on the outside versus the inside, because it was clear that Obama by the summer of Obama of 2009, that Obama was already backtracking on a lot of stuff that he said was really important to him, particularly the bankruptcy bill was the first thing.
You bet.
And then I remember when we launched this show, one of the first guests we had, maybe the first one, was Winner Takes All Economy. I think it was like Jacob Hacker's book. I think so.
Uh-huh.
But I remember the idea being like, nobody's talking about this, you know, the concentration of wealth. I mean, you know, Bernie had been talking about it, but Bernie Sanders was way off the national radar. I don't think he had ever been on a national program except for like maybe a Donahue intro, you know, sort of like documentary piece. Like, look at this guy. This is crazy. He's a socialist who's running, you know, he's the mayor of Burlington or something. I mean, we had him on the old Majority Report, but there was no one else talking about that. The words wealth inequality, the concept of the 99%, it did not exist at that time. in terms of like mass media and broad conversation? Obviously, there's been people who've been talking about it for forever, including Bernie. But the, in terms of like the way that you would hear it in the news or the national psyche, it just was not there. And in some respects, that's what I think what took people for, you know, such a surprise with Occupy, at least the sort of the broader society. And I remember it was another guy, I think his name is DeGraw, David DeGraw, I think his name was, who had this concept of, you know, there was a bunch of different people who were responsible, I think, for Occupy. You know, some of it came out of Adbuster, some of it was David Graeber. There were others. But this guy, David DeGraw, earlier that year had been trying to writing or talking about stuff that within X amount of miles of Wall Street, there was a huge number of people who had been devastated by, you know, the 2008 crisis. And I think people were still, you know, people remember when we're talking about 2010, we're really only like 12 months out from when it really, the crap hit the fan, right? I mean, it was in the fall of 2008, right before the election, that we hadn't even quite bottomed out. I don't think the bottom was hit until like early 2009 or so, maybe even mid 2009 in terms of job losses and whatnot. So this is very fresh in the mind, I think. It, you know, we were the financial crisis had hit, but the sort of reverberations were still happening, and people, I think, were just not conscious of what was going on. And since Occupy, the idea of wealth inequality as the primary problem in this country just got just exploded, and it impacted everything. I agree with you. I don't think there is like 10% as much a recognition of how quickly this country has moved to the left, or how strong the left has become in these 10 years as there should be, because that is really the primary story.
Well, that's what I think. And I have been, you know, I mostly cover what's happening with the right wing. It's always been sort of my beat. And so I'm very interested and, you know, frankly, frightened to death of what they have become. So, you know, I tend to keep my eyes on that. But it seems obvious to me, and those of us who've been, you know, watching politics closely on the internet for the last couple of decades, people like you and me have been doing this sort of thing, you can really see the change. I mean, if I go back and look at the stuff I was writing back in the early 2000s on my blog and, you know, the forums and various places where we were all discussing this stuff, we were way, way out of the mainstream. I mean, yep. There just was nothing, as you point out. And it, you know, of course, the financial crisis was the catalyst. But, you know, and there, of course, you know, you have to give credit to not just politicians like Bernie, but there were economists and others who were going, you know, whoa, something's really going to happen here. And they've been talking about it for a while. But the reaction that happened to it with Occupy Wall Street, which was, I mean, it really shocked people. I don't know if people remember, you know, I mean, the press was walking around like they were, you know, doing anthropological,
yep.
You know, sort of missions deep into the Amazon. I mean, the way they were looking at the people who were doing this. And, you know, that Occupy had tried to do a lot of things, you know, a lot of things that they were experimenting with and doing it, you know, in these various, you know, occupied territories around the country, around the world. I mean, let's not forget, this was a global thing.
Yep.
I mean, it wasn't just happening here. And it the fact that reaction happened that way, that this was kind of, you know, I mean, this is a version of street protest that was kind of unique. I mean, you know, we hadn't seen anything quite like that. And I think it was very effective in implanting, particularly in the younger generation who, you know, I mean, this may have been for many people, you know, their first sort of contact with the left.
It was for me.
It was for Jamie.
I mean, I protested the Iraq War in high school. We did not stop the Iraq War. I kind of gave up and did drugs for a few years. And then I got involved again around the time of Occupy. And I haven't stopped being involved since then.
Or taking drugs.
Yes, well, I have not stopped taking drugs.
There you go. But you know that definitely, you know, I can see that, because if that's a moment of kind of clarity for, and there are a lot of young people your age, you know, I mean, this is a big, big generation, and the fact that that was sort of happening there, I think that may have fueled what we're seeing, and it goes in a number of different directions. It's not just economics. I mean, this is about a certain form of activism and just general worldview, you know, I mean, when climate change and guns and Black Lives Matter, I mean, there's all this stuff that sort of has bubbled up in the last 10 years as a, you know, and I would categorize all of that as being part of the left. I think that's, you know, that moment really did sort of, you know, it opened the eyes of a generation. And I think that it's going to look, you know, be remembered as something very important in the development of world politics.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And a lot of people went on from that and applied lessons to other places. And it's interesting too. In many respects, it in some ways it launched both. In terms of like national acclaim and their sort of their identities, it launched both Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders. And I think in terms of like it empowered both of them in different ways at different points over the course of the decade. I also think that part of this is that, and I don't want to reduce it too much, but I think coincidentally, or maybe not coincidentally, I mean, maybe there's, you know, somebody could draw some type of correlation or some type of causation between the age in which boomers became in the aughts and their aggressiveness in terms of like seeking, you know, wealth, and it being driven by these innovations. And, you know, it's hard to sort of disentangle this stuff, but there was a fire lit, there were embers, and I think, and there was obviously this sort of like inciting moment in terms of the financial crisis. But I also think, as someone who's, you know, a member of a generation that's sort of like, will never, you know, Generation X is always going to be, you know, in the back seat. Right. It's not, we weren't in the front seat for a long time because the boomers were there. And then the millennials essentially just the first time they got into the car, it feels like they were in the front seat. And the reason is, I'm quite convinced, it's just sheer numbers. I mean, we live in a consumer based society. And, you know, whether it's actually, you know, purchasing or just consuming media and also generating media. And the fact is that the boomers, the amount of boomers in our society was such that they dictated our culture and our politics and every aspect of our society. And the Gen X just never had room and never had the purchasing power, you know, just to reduce it down to that. I think it's an oversimplification, but it gets the point across. Never had the purchasing power to change society and the market, if you will. But millennials come in and they, I mean, ironically, don't actually have the purchasing power, but they have the cultural consumption power, let's say.
Yeah.
A lot of these things don't cost anything except for your data, right?
Right. I mean, I'm just using that as an analogy, because I think it's actually sort of like specifically untethered from that, because, you know,
cultural capital, I think, is the word they use.
Yes, thank you. And it's the cultural capital. But it's because of sheer numbers, I think, really,
right,
at the end of the day.
Right.
I mean, I think that when you have the ability, when you get that sort of feedback of like, oh, there's a lot of people who are experiencing what I'm experiencing now, which is our aggregate wealth is, you know, a third of what it would have been if we had been born 30 years ago or 40 years ago, 50 years ago. And, our ability to sort of change culture is like, you know, the way it is with young people, except for we have the buying power, the consumption power. We can create our new, you know, and I think that crested during this decade as well. And I think we're seeing that now. We're seeing it like, you know, with this new generation. I mean, there's a reason it seems to me that like we have the two, this is a little reductive too, but the most powerful segments of our Congress right now are people who are nearing 80 years old, right? In terms of Democrats, and people who are just nearing 30 years old. I mean, that's pretty stunning. And I don't, you know, like I mean, maybe that happens a lot in history, but when you look at the, like the two biggest fundraisers in the Democratic Party in the House, it's Nancy Pelosi and AOC. And I think that is also the story of like what this, you know, in this next decade will be the AOC's, the squad's decade, however you want to say it, it will be their decade. But this is the one that sort of gave rise to it.
Absolutely. And that is looking at the future. I mean, that is where it is. Now, I will say this, just to, you know, being a boomer, I have to point this out, that Nancy Pelosi, Joe Biden, Bernie Sanders, the rest, they're not actually boomers. They're silent. They're older than most boomers are. That means nothing other than just to say it. But yes, the baby boom. And also just, you know, you have to look at the fact that, you know, the baby boom are, you know, they're getting old and they're going to die. I mean, they'll be around, though, for a while. They're, you know, I should say we, because I'm one of them. They're going to, you know, we're going to be around for the next 20 years or so in a large numbers, and we'll have to be accommodated on some level. But yes, the next decade is the rise of the millennials, or the assumption of you know, cultural, you know, ascendancy of the millennials. And, you know, this is good news for those of us who care about all these issues, because the millennial generation is very, I mean, not all. I mean, you don't want to paint with too broad a brush, because there is, you know, there is an ascendant right as well, and there's plenty of young people that are involved in that. But the vast majority are, you know, liberal, tolerant, you know, concerned people about all the issues that those of us on the left, boomers and otherwise, have been caring about for decades, and kind of flailing against a very, very organized right wing that has done everything in its power to stop us from doing the things that we believed in. And they are also aging out, and they're also their movement, the conservative movement, which has been ascendant since I was a kid, you know, going all the way back to Goldwater, it's dead now. I'm not sure what's going to replace it, but whatever they called it, thought they were, and called themselves, is no longer operative. I mean, there is no ideology anymore. This is purely just a tribal kind of cult that is, you know, concerned with plutocracy and power, and there's nothing else to it. So, you know, we are entering a very, very untrod sort of time. You know, this, we don't know where the ideology is going, but I do kind of on the right, but I do see it on the left seems pretty coherent to me. And that kind of gives me hope, because that's the group I'm with, that I've always been with, and I'm glad to be with them as I get older and they start to take power, because I feel actually optimistic about that. If we can get through these few years of transition, I think that the next, you know, the next epoch in American history, in the world's history, you know, theoretically anyway, should be a lot better with this particular group.
I think that's actually also another great point is, and you know, I remember in, you know, 04, 05, you know, reading Sullivan, I can't even remember his first name now, and
Andrew
Sullivan, and him writing about how there are members of the, you know, of the conservative universe, you know, we used to call them movement conservatives, but there are members of the conservative universe who are not preaching, like, you know, George Bush is not a true conservative. And I remember at the time saying, like, this dude doesn't quite get it. Like, this is like saying, you know, people are just not speaking Latin enough anymore. And, and it's, you don't even hear people making that argument anymore. Like it's so far gone. The conservative ideology is so bereft, that, and even almost like Republicanism has lost any, it has become untethered, right? Like the whole thing about the deficit goals. Now, I'm quite convinced that Republicans are going to reconvene in some fashion. Like, you know, I keep reading about, you know, these never Trumpers who are out there going like, the Republican Party has finally destroyed itself by supporting Donald Trump in this thing or that thing. And I feel like that article, I've been reading it the same thing for 3 years. and the fact of the matter is that they are, they need nothing to reconvene and reconstruct themselves. They will just come back as they were and pretend like none of this ever happened. But the problem is the ideology has been hollowed out. There is no ideology, and it becomes almost at that point, it becomes untethered. Even if they never believed it, you lose the watershed in which you're telling your stories about it. And that is, that's when I think, you know, it's not hard for me to imagine we continue on with this intense polarization, and it is, you know, we watched, you and I watched the right move further out on the sort of the spectrum of the you know, to the right, and we're now seeing the left say like, well, we have some ideas too, and are actually headed out in that way too, which is, and getting stronger, frankly, which is increasing the polarization. And in my estimation, it's the only way to go. You know, there's no going around this. We need to go through it. And, but on the, when we do get towards the other end of that side, you know, the idea of like, the conservative movement is, you know, 30% of the country, and, they're, aiding and abetting, you know, sort of like, right-wing terrorist, you know, it's not hard to come up with that scenario. Let's put it that way.
It really isn't. And I mean, I've been watching this my whole life, and they look, the conservative movement was the most powerful political movement in America through most of my lifetime. I mean, we're talking about, you know, starting with the 70s going forward up until really pretty recently. They pretty much owned our politics. Now, again, the cultural capital that the baby boomers had was much more liberal. I mean, we saw a lot of changes with you know, gay rights and women's rights and civil rights and, you know, across the board. There was a lot of progress made during that period. But on a political level, the right owned it, really. The left has been flailing, you know, through that entire period.
I feel like we were this close to getting Reagan on a dime.
Yeah. Oh, we were. I mean, they had a thing called the Reagan Legacy Project, where they were renaming all these airports. I mean, you see it all over the place, you know, in schools and roads. I mean, they were going to turn him. This was a kind of a Leninist approach, spearheaded by a guy named Grover Norquist.
Yep.
And, you know, you haven't heard much from him lately.
No.
And, you know, of course, he got his big tax cut. So, you know, he's probably just counting his money somewhere. But, you know, this has been the political story of my lifetime up until now. And that's one reason why I sort of flagged the Occupy Wall Street as being sort of, you know, the big, you know, the financial crisis and Occupy Wall Street as a huge catalyst for change. And what has happened in its wake is that we're seeing the crumbling of what was called the conservative movement for 40 years. And what is going to replace it, I don't know. I think you're right. I mean, I'm kind of terrified by it in a way, because there is a lot of tribal identification among those people, and driven by all the things we talk about all the time, the racial animus and the sense of, you know, having their prerogatives and their privileges being challenged by women and people of color and foreigners and everything else. So, you know, they're not going to go away. I mean, these people still exist, and they may, you know, it's a white party, basically, people with a lot of money behind them. There's that whole, you know, kleptocracy, plutocracy that undergirds everything they've done for many, many years, and that's not going to go away. So I'm not saying that the fight is over. I think in some ways it's just beginning. But it's a different fight than the one we've been having. And I think that's where you get the young people coming in. They have a much greater sense of confidence about this, and rightly so. You know, for people like me who were, you know, I'm thinking back to the Reagan years, you know, where it's just like, oh, geez, you know, you got to be kidding me. I mean, it was like we didn't even exist. We were like, you know, completely Democrats sounded like right-wing Republicans. I mean, it was really, really kind of, it was depressing for anybody who cared about any of these issues. And that's just not true anymore. It's a different thing. The fight is now engaged. And I always used to say, for years, you know, this isn't a pendulum that we're talking about. It's a seesaw. And unless the left gets some heft on its side, we're going to be hanging out up there while the right wing continues to you know, hold down every, you know, all the power and all the, you know, the resources and everything else in politics. So, you know, this is what's changing. And the character of it, I can't really describe. I don't know. And I'm afraid there's, you know, there could be violence. It could be something, you know, pretty awful, because in the context that this is happening, of climate change, for instance, we're going to see a lot of disruption, and it's not going to be pretty. But I don't think that we're going in unarmed this time. I don't think that the left is without, you know, is kind of, you know, in as vulnerable position as it was for the last 40 years.
I mean, you know, the other one last thing, and then we'll talk about what happened last night, but. I just think one of the markers for that is, I just remember in 2004, getting phone calls from right wingers on the radio going like, you're a liberal. And I'd say, well, actually, I mean, I'm to the left of that, but, you know, so, and he's like, well, you just admitted it. And I'm like, well, I'm on a liberal talk radio network. Like, it was to call yourself a liberal in this country in the late 90s, early aughts was particularly in the early aughts after 9/11 was in some areas dangerous. I mean, like, literally
was.
Dangerous. And because
after 9/11, it sure was
because of you know, the potential for right wing violence. I mean, this is not theoretical and or hypothetical. And within 10, 12 years of that time, when you call yourself a liberal, it is, or when someone calls you a liberal, it is, to the extent that it's like supposed to be an insult, it is coming from the left.
That is true.
And that to me is
guilty
just
as charged.
That is just, I mean, that is an amazing turnabout, you know? I mean, it is just an amazing change in our society. I mean, I think that's sort of like now, like, I don't know that people who aren't involved in politics are not, you know, are quite as aware of that. I don't think that's, you know, if I was to say to, you know, I don't know, some civilians, you know, some normies that you're a liberal, they wouldn't go, okay, whatever. what's for dinner? You know, but I think the idea within this type of, you know, within our type of profession and in our, you know, sort of, you know, our non-civilian world, as it were, that's pretty stunning, I think.
It is. And, you know, liberal and progressive, both of those words and the arguments that we have within our own coalition over that, notwithstanding, neither of those words are now used as, you know, just outright epithets by, you know, average society, I don't think. And
right.
That was not true 20 years ago.
That's right.
I mean, you were a communist or maybe even, you know, a child molester or something. I mean, it was terrible. It was really fearful to assume that word to describe yourself in some company. I mean, I have conservative relatives, and I was kind of, you know, maybe, you know, okay, well, I, you know, I vote Democratic some of the time, you know, but and then walk away from the conversation because that was not something that you wanted to call yourself. And I think that anybody now, you say I'm a progressive or a liberal or whatever, and I don't think it gets that same response in, you know, polite society that it did, you know, 20, 25 years ago.
Right. I mean, you know, Michael Dukakis was afraid to be labeled a liberal, and not because that would signify that he did not have a, you know, a Marxist critique of what's going on. It was, right. It was, you know, because he did, if he was called that. But go ahead.
Can I say something about Occupy? I feel like it's fairly on topic because we're talking about it, and I was a part of Occupy Wall Street and really forged a lot of the politics I have now at that point in time. It also didn't hurt that I was dating sort of a libertarian communist. But the primary goal of Occupy Wall Street was not to realign the Democratic Party. And it wasn't to elect a social Democrat president. It might be a good outcome of it. But I mean, the people that I knew, the people that I met around that time were very principled anarchists and libertarian communists, those types who really had a horizon level goal of overthrowing capitalism. Nobody thought that we were going to do it by occupying Wall Street, but it was the start of something. And we've seen, you know, uprisings around the world. And I think perhaps the liberal left, the progressive left is stronger than it used to be. The anti-capitalist left is also stronger than it used to be, but it's still incredibly weak. Like, DSA has 60,000 members, I think, or thereabouts. It's about as strong as it's been maybe since the 60s. Still not strong enough to accomplish our goals. But, like, I still hope that we can have some sort of popular front of the left with leftists and liberals. And I appreciate the love that you guys are giving to Occupy right now because, like, it shows that you recognize, even if you don't agree with anarchists and communists, that you need us as part of some larger left movement and popular front. And like, I'm hoping, like I said the other day, I see a few different paths forward to like solve the problems, the crisis that capitalism is in right now and has been in arguably since the 70s. One of them goes through social democracy and a parliamentary road to socialism. The other one involves a lot more human misery to come first. And, you know, given those choices, I would of course prefer the one that involves less human misery. And I think you guys are probably in agreement with me on that.
Yeah, of course. And I would say, I mean, my experience of having been down at Zuccotti Park and gone to a couple of the other encampments and talking to a lot of people at the time was that there was a diversity. I mean, there's certainly, I think, you know, the group of folks, you know, associated with Graeber that started, you know, Zuccotti were definitely more sort of like anarcho in various flavors, I think, of that.
Yeah, fresh off the New School occupation.
Yes.
Too.
But there was also, like I say, this David DeGraw who had a sort of a contemporaneous idea, I think was probably more of like an anti-finance type of lefty. And I think there was my sense was that there was a sort of a broad range of people who were literally at Zuccotti and certainly coming out for the marches.
It's where Tim Pool made his bones.
It's where Tim Pool and the guy he was with actually going around was quite good. And I can't remember his name, but I think he recognized that there was something up with Tim Pool quite early. But there was a broad range of people, from my experience at Zuccotti, and I was, you know, down there, I was not obviously sleeping out there, but was down there on a fairly regular basis, interviewing people.
One of my critiques as well of anarchist horizontalism, which is that it is a little too open-ended and a little too disorganized and can decay into all different sorts of liberalism and even conservatism if you're not careful.
But even in the first like week, there was a mix of people there. I mean that, you know, and I think like it's certainly sort of anti-hierarchy folks drove the place without a doubt. I mean, I think, and that's, you know, that cuts both ways in some ways, but regardless of, you know, I don't think it's controversial to say that, like, you know, when things move to the left, it's because, you know, people on the furthest most regions of the left are pulling it that way. And different people end up, you know, in the sort of the concentric circles. And in my experience, anyways, it usually lands not you know, close to the polls. It's just a question of, like, you know, how far is the poll on the left? But yeah,
it was definitely instructive for me as well. Like, I decided not to be a full-on anarchist after that, because I was like, well, I feel like we could be a little better organized in some ways. And, you know, some of these folks need a more Marxist material analysis, which is, like, I did not know what that meant at the time, but I just knew that it was something I wanted.
You just knew you had to get away from the drum circles. And
that's for sure.
All right. So, Heather, let's move back. Let's become a little bit less reflective and a little bit less theoretical and a little bit more substantive about the, you know, we're talking about, like, the sort of the folly of trying to recap the decade. But I think actually we did a pretty good job of that, to be honest with you. I wouldn't want to recap this year, because that's like, you'd actually have to go through, like, there's no way for me to get a sense of the, you know, sort of like the broad strokes of this year at this point. I feel like I'm about to pass out. And even this week seems sort of more than I could digest. But there are two big stories this week, it seems to me, or really one big story. But in the debate, I think, was also, we've had a turning point in the race, in the Democratic race, I think, is also the case. The big story this week is Nancy Pelosi holding back these articles of impeachment, because as far as I can tell, it is the first sort of, like, proactive, aggressive move, power move by the Democrats in, and that I can remember in a long time. And let me just sort of qualify this by saying, meanwhile, the legislation that was passed this week, I think, is largely garbage and has not gotten the scrutiny that it deserves. But I think there's a certain inevitability to this type of thing in this era. But I'm trying to stay positive and see that the exercise of power by the Democrats, and I'm just convinced that this generation of Democrats that's in charge right now is never going to get us to where we need to get from a sort of policy standpoint. But at least the idea of, like, this is what it feels like when Democrats exercise some type of power, and it's not a huge power, but withholding those articles of impeachment is like it's a power play.
Oh, there's no doubt about it. I wrote about this for Salon this morning. And it, of course, it's a power play. And it was very surprising for the reason that you just, you know, sort of indicated. I didn't expect it. I honestly didn't. Everything I saw from the leadership of the Democratic Party was that this was going to be an extremely buttoned-up conservative approach to impeachment, which always struck me as bizarre, since impeachment is anything but that. It's the most political act, really, that the Congress can make. And I'm not talking about partisan political. I'm just saying this is an exercise of power by the U.S. Congress against a sitting president. And that's one reason why it doesn't happen very often. They usually work out their differences before it gets to that point.
And Trump, it's so unprecedented that there's no roadmaps for it. Like, there's, you know, right. It's like people are saying, like, you know, what Pelosi's doing, you know, Noah Feldman came out the other day, the guy who testified on behalf of the Democrats saying that this was impeachable. He wrote an op-ed saying, well, impeachment hasn't happened until they deliver these articles of impeachment to the Senate, which is, all right, fine. To tell the New York Times to issue a correction on their headline
exactly.
The other day.
No, he hasn't been impeached. And by the way, fine, because I think they should continue with impeachment.
Exactly.
There's a lot more to talk about it with that. So fine. We didn't really impeach him. We're just in the process. And that's fine with me. And I think that Pelosi, you know, this was a surprising move, but, you know, it makes perfect sense to me.
Yep.
I mean, I don't, you know, there's, a, of course, you know, this is what Democrats and what, you know, liberals, progressives, all of us on this side deal with, which is the hand-wringing about absolutely everything. Any kind of use of partisan power is that you always get the hand-wringing from, oh, my goodness, it doesn't look good, and, you know, she shouldn't do this, and blah, blah, blah. Well, you know, whatever. And I actually am impressed with the fact that Pelosi is saying, talk to the hand. I'm doing what I'm doing. I don't care what the Republicans say. You don't know what you're talking about. And she's just kind of dismissing all of this pearl-clutching over what she did. of course it makes sense. What is happening here, and you and I've talked about this a lot, Sam, on the other show, is that, you know, they're looking at a Senate here that they've got about 6 seats that are potentially flippable to the Democrats in 2020. And what that McConnell is desperate to do is to hold a perfunctory, you know, quick and dirty process that just blah, 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 you know, have a couple of days where some people say some stuff and then they vote, and that's that. And Trump walks, you know, struts around saying he's been totally exonerated, which really isn't the point. What he's trying to do is protect those people from having to take a public vote on something that really looks controversial. Right. Nancy Pelosi got some polling this week that shows that the vast majority of everyone in the country thinks that witnesses should be called for this Senate trial. And logic says, what's he so afraid of? You know, if he had a perfect call, if all this has been fine, then there's no problem. Why don't they have the witnesses? And that included 64% of Republicans. That was not something that Mitch McConnell wanted to deal with. And she saw that, and she and her leadership decided, okay, let's push this. Let's see how far we can get with this. Because McConnell, you know, I mean, up until the moment when the trial starts, he has, you know, tremendous power over the Senate and the process and how that whole thing is going to unfold. Once it starts, he's just another member of the Senate, and everything goes according to a different set of rules than usual. But right now, the power is in Nancy Pelosi's hand, and she's decided to use it to try and force them, knowing that, you know, Donald Trump is going to go crazy because he wants his exoneration, right? I mean, this is, he's been impeached, but he hasn't been exonerated, and he is losing it, and you can tell that he is. I mean, he's obviously, you know, on a razor's edge. So she's playing this. Now, I don't know how long she's going to carry it out. I don't know what the result will be. Maybe they won't get their witnesses, or maybe it'll be some kind of tepid compromise that doesn't really get them everywhere where they want to be. But showing this power, and I'm telling you, you know, it's long past time for the Democratic Party to recognize that their people need some red meat fed to them every once in a while, too. You know, we're not sitting out here, you know, maybe everybody thinks we eat arugula, but we need our protein. And, you know, every once in a while, they need to give us a little something too, show that we've got some backbone and that we've got, you know, a little bit of power on our side. So I'm all for it, and you know, she can hold it out as long as she wants. As far as I'm concerned, I recognize that political, you know, that the political, you know,
pressure is going to build, right?
Yeah, may require her to give in before I might want, but I'm very happy with what she did. And by the way, another point that I just want to make quickly. There's a lot of stuff happening right now with this Ukraine stuff, with Rudy Giuliani's out there shooting off his mouth. You know, Lindsey Graham went on TV yesterday and said, you know, basically told him to shut up, saying, you know, if you're going on TV and you're saying this stuff, you better know what you're talking about, right? Because they are very concerned about what Rudy is doing, and with the fact that there is money flowing in from Russia to Lev Parnas, Rudy's accomplice in this whole thing. And Trump is not paying for any of his defense. So, you know, you could make the case that maybe, you know, the Russians are paying for his defense. Along with that, there's this big scoop in the Washington Post this week about how all these senior officials, by the way, who are still too chicken shit to, you know, put their names out there, who say that Trump's been saying from the beginning that Putin's the one who's been telling him in their secret meetings that Ukraine is the ones who interfered in the election in 2016. So, you know, these Republicans don't know what shoe is going to drop. This story is still alive. Whether or not they want to get the impeachment over with, assured in their minds that Pelosi won't do it again.
Right.
But this story, as long as it's sitting out there, there are Ukrainian and Russian shoes dropping all over the place, and anything could happen. They know that. I mean, it probably won't, but you just don't know. It's making them very, very nervous. So that alone is worth it to me. Let them have a little nervous Christmas. I think that's fine.
Well,
you know,
and
enjoy.
And I would say a couple of things. One is that the longer Pelosi does this, the more damage it does to these Republicans who don't want to take that vote. Because every day it's a news story. It builds this notion of that vote that Susan Collins or that, Tom Tillis or that Cory Gardner, the vote they're taking is a controversial one. And, you know, I don't know that people look at the specifics, but, you know, that's the way it sticks in their heads. The other thing I would say, based upon what you've said, is that there's two other points too. Devin Nunes was on TV the other day trying to explain how Lev Parnas called his office and spoke to people at his office. And now he's suggesting that maybe he was talking to Lev Parnas's wife. Now,
oh, that's not good.
Well, when you feel like you need to imply that you're having an affair with this guy's wife as a way of saying that I was not in contact with him, that to me suggests that a mild state of panic has set in.
Exactly.
And talk about having a cow, had to say it. And but yeah, and I think you're right about this. I think like they are worried about this being a live wire, and that's unhealthy to them. All right, let's just say a quick 5 minutes about the debate last night. I'm going to talk about it more later in the program. We did a wrap up, you know, immediately following last night. If you had to say, if I appointed you Chris Sliza for the day, but only in format, not so much in the way, not so much in the content. All right, let me rephrase that. I'm Chris Saliza's editor. You're not Chris Saliza. And I say to you, who are the three winners and the three losers last night?
Well, if I were Chris Saliza, I'd say it's so boring. I don't know why anyone would ever listen to it. because that's how he looks at anything reeks of real politics.
Exactly.
The three winners. Well, that's really interesting because, you know, to me, of course, being, you know, a member of the left, if not the anarcho libertarian communist left, I have to look at Warren and Sanders, who I think continue to just, you know, they're as steady as she goes. And, you know, between the two of them, their polling looks really good for left-leaning politics in the Democratic Party. So I think that Pete Buttigieg did very badly. I think that he has, you know, I mean, I'm personally don't enjoy watching TED Talks. I certainly don't want to see one at a Democratic debate, and that's what it always looks like to me when he starts talking. He needs to have one of those microphones, you know, with the...
Right, that come across the face.
Sort of glued
and
to
like,
his
yeah.
cheek, you know, one of those, and we're just walking around the stage. I mean, it's just, you know, come on, dude. And anyway, you know, I'm sorry. You know, this is just not where the party is. And I am, you know, I'm very hopeful that he fades away shortly. I hate to say it, but I think just on a performance level and the way that the party, the media sort of reviewed it, I think Amy Klobuchar did well. She sort of stood out, and maybe she's going to step into the Buttigieg slot, which is the centrist lane, as they put it, you know, competing with Joe Biden. And, you know, Biden was Biden. I mean, he is who he is. I don't know. The affection for him kind of escapes me. I don't have a feeling for that. Not that I have much of a feeling for politicians generally. It's not really how I make my assessments of them. But, you know, I think he seemed to be, aware of where he was. I mean, I guess that's a good thing. I don't know what to say other than I think that, you know, we're seeing, I did miss seeing people like Cory Booker and Castro. I know that's a cliche at this point, but I do think that it would be helpful for the Democratic Party to have a fully diverse slate going into the primaries rather than sort of having it be whittled down to mostly white people and, septuagenarians. and Pete Buttigieg. I don't know what to say other than when I wrote about it this morning or right after the debate saying that I felt like sometimes when I go and watch these debates, I feel like it seems surreal to me because it feels like it's some other world that politics exists in than the one that I am immersed in day after day, which is this freak show.
Yeah. But I think that's good. I think that's good. I think that we're the
well, that's
idea
what I said
that
after
they,
after, yeah. Yeah, after after I started listening, I said, you know, it kind of felt like, you know, a comfortable pair of shoes, and I was able to sort of relax and kind of go, oh, okay, you know, this is actual political discussion. So, you know, in that sense, I don't know if other people feel that, but I do.
And the thing I still, you know, and we've already said this, and this maybe brings it full circle. The thing that I just, you know, and maybe I'm used to it now, and, you know, we saw some of this in 2016 in the race between Sanders and Clinton, but just the idea that we're hearing about these proposals and ideas and talking about things like, you know, free college or free healthcare at the point of service, a wealth tax and this and that. And the people who are presenting these ideas are sitting in the middle of the room, and it's December, as opposed to you would hear one or two people say this in the first debate that would take place in the summer of before the primary, and they would be on the wings essentially, and it would be their one or two sentences that they get to talk about. And half the time they were also sort of like, that's all we want to hear from them because they're a little bit unsound on just about everything else. Like the idea that you can actually see the physical representation of the centering of politics that were sort of like just completely out of the realm, you know, 10, 15 years ago, is horribly encouraging. And I just hope it, I hope we get more of it. But Heather,
absolutely.
Thank you so much, folks. Digby is doing her annual fundraiser. There is no job that is less thankful than a blogger.
Facts.
We are, I feel so blessed to have had your work, Heather, and this is not a retrospect. I'm hoping it goes forward as well, of course. But I'm saying over the, I don't know, almost 15 years that I've been reading you. Maybe it's 13. I can't quite remember.
It's 18. I hate to tell you.
Oh, boy. All right. Well, so, folks, head over to Digby's site and hit the donate or subscribe button on the left. Old school style, non-Patreon. Although we should, if you want to talk about that, I think you should start a Patreon. But
Maybe I should.
No, I think you should. We'll talk about that. But in the meantime, folks, head over there and show some love to Digby. Heather, thank you so much. I really appreciate your time today.
Oh, thanks for having me, Sam. I really appreciate that. Thanks so much. And hey, happy holidays to everybody.
Right, exactly. Have a great New Year, great Christmas, if that's what you do. And thank you so much for everything you've done this year. And I want to apologize in advance for next year.
Man, you said the C word again.
I know. I've lost the war on Christmas. Bye, Digby.
Bye-bye.
All right, folks. Going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Matthew Film Guy, who has been incredibly patient because we're running late. We're going to run late today. Last show of the year. All right. Be right back.
Bad movie where there's no crying, handing the keys to me in this red line, where the lock that you locked in the suite says there's no prying, when the breath that you breathe in the street screams there's no science, when you look how you looked then to me that I cease lying and fall into silence. This is a life story, so there's no climax.
We are back, ladies and gentlemen, in our never-ceasing attempt to bring you news from every corner of the world. We have finally, after years and years of talking about it and planning about it, we have finally figured out how to commission a Sundance Film Festival reporter, and this is his theme song. Matthew, film guy, welcome to the program. You are, I know that you are just walking on cloud nine, having won the Majority Report Sundance Stringer sweepstakes.
Absolutely.
That this has been a huge, huge boon for you. And how much are you looking forward to being our stringer at Sundance?
I mean, it's the entire reason I edited this film, is just to be able to do this for the Majority Report and you, Sam.
Which film is that?
Huh?
Which film is that?
So the film that I have mentioned on the show in the past, Black Bear, starring Aubrey Plaza, and this is your cue to talk about Parks and Rec for like a third time. But
I've never seen that movie.
I've never seen Parks and Rec.
I don't like sitcoms. I don't think comedy.
Yeah, Aubrey Plaza, star of Parks and Rec, and many other fine entertainment. Now including Black Bear. That film that I edited this summer, and we just are wrapping up now, has gotten into the Sundance Film Festival, and will be premiering there in January. And I will be going out there.
Wait! Let the fanfare. You just to fill in those blanks. So say it again, Michael.
Sorry. Matthew. A little bit of a delay here. I'm almost on the libertarian line.
All right. So Matthew, say just the part about what happened with Black Bear.
Black Bear got into Sundance.
And it's funny you say my name, because I am going to go to Sundance to party with Matthew in January.
Is that right?
And I won't be here.
Oh, that's that
potential.
Right? I wouldn't mind doing that. Maybe. Do you need help?
Yeah.
No. Hey, come on out. We got a rented a big condo, Mary and I did, for the cast and the crew to stay in. It's pretty full, but we can always grab some kitchen floor for you, Michael, whatever needs to happen. We're going to be going out there and enjoying ourselves for like 5 or 6 days. And, I'm looking forward to seeing a lot of movies and attending some swanky events.
Well, that's really exciting. I mean, to edit a film that gets into Sundance Film Festival is basically this is the peak, right? I mean, I guess theoretically you could get a Palme d'Or or something at Cannes, but
you thought of something better there. Yeah, you did. Good job.
Okay, well, it'd be nice. I mean, Toronto is also a very, very prestigious Toronto Film Festival.
Yeah, that one's also good. There's like five sort of like inner circle festivals.
Okay.
But
all right.
The premiere at Sundance is amazing, especially for a lower budget indie film like this, which raises its profile, gets the chances of it being distributed way up there. So, that's sort of the next plateau for it to hit. But
that's
I'm
huge.
Very proud of the way the movie came out. So I have every confidence that's going to happen.
Well, congratulations. That's a huge deal. I had a couple years in the independent film world, and so I know how big of a deal this is and what it could mean for you. Although, did you get into the Bermuda Film Festival?
Oh, wow. No, I'm not even sure. When's that deadline? We got to scramble. I'm not sure.
What about the Brooklyn Jewish Film Festival? Did you get into that one?
He teaches
Brookline?
It.
Brookline.
Oh, my
Jewish
God.
Film Festival.
This is getting embarrassing.
I'm just going over the ones that I know were the most prestigious back in the day when my film was.
Matthew.
I mean,
did Matthew?
What about the Seattle Jewish Film Festival?
When Matthew was 13, he submitted a film to the Brookline Jewish Festival, and it was about an evil rabbi who over-circumcises babies. It was a horror film.
Is that true,
Matthew?
I really wish it was true.
I was going to say.
Sounds like a great movie.
I don't know if you saw any of his early work, but that would not have surprised me whatsoever. No, no.
I'm drawing this joke out of some experience with Matthew's
The over-circumcizer. That's really a good idea.
Over-circumcizer.
It doesn't sound that much more offensive than what Sam's film was about. So.
Wait, what? Oh, no, no, that's a different film.
The rabbi's here.
The Orthodox Jewish postal workers, is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, I think that's what she was referring to.
I'm talking about the Jewish terrorists.
Yeah, that didn't...
Right,
that,
yeah.
That film...
Sure, no, that was my
not,
favorite. That's what drew me to that project.
That film
but,
was
Sam, I actually can only hope that once we're at Sundance, that we win the prestigious Black Diamond Award. That's really, to me, would be the grabbing
well,
the...
I can arrange that to happen. I am on the selection committee. In fact, I am the selection committee. And,
that's what I thought. I just thought I'd drop that, see if you can hook us up.
Tell me what the rates are for a 3/4 page in Variety these days, and I can make that happen, my man.
Okay. All right. We'll talk off air.
I mean, yeah. I mean, you, frankly, so far, you're the only film that has submitted, and I don't really need to view them to make my decision. So
that's excellent.
Well, all right, that's exciting. And, you know, of course, you will be calling into the show from Sundance.
Yes.
As you are credentialed from
yep.
the show.
Yep.
And that is.
Yep. I'm going to be the official Majority Report correspondent at Sundance for the time that I'm there. I hope to be able to see plenty of movies, report back to you on all the goings on. And I hope to take hundreds of selfies. For free.
Oh my God. Please do.
That's good. That is bingo. And this is in Park City, is that right?
Yep. Park City, biatch.
Right. Of course. Is it necessary that you add that at the end of it? I thought it was in Utah.
It's a song. Michael got it.
Okay.
But anyway.
Gotcha.
Yes, it's in Park City. It's like a, you know, it's like a swanky ski town that just like gets descended upon by the sort of Hollywood liberal elite scum.
You gonna hit the slopes?
Be one of them.
You gonna hit the slopes? You gonna ski or snowboard at all?
No, I avoid anything having to do with skiing or going downhill or really anything physically active. But I'll be watching a lot of movies inside in the dark as much as possible.
And
there's a lot of great movies coming out there that I'm really looking forward to. A lot of new work from directors I like, so it's going to be very exciting. I've already been to one kind of meet and greet here in New York where I saw a couple people whose films are definitely on my short list.
I had a couple years out there. I saw Pi when it was first released, when Darren Aronofsky and I were friends at the
love
time.
That movie.
And Louis C.K. had
a 98. 98, 99,
it must
maybe.
Have been. I think I was there 2 years in a row. One was for Next Stop Wonderland, I think, was there. And,
okay, yeah, Brad Anderson, sure.
And I spent the night, one of the nights there, getting drunk, driving around town or going around town in like the shuttle buses with Michael Chiklis of the Commish.
Oh, wow. The Commish.
Yeah, the dude was from Massachusetts, and we just sort of like, I don't know if he was on that show at that time. I just remember hanging out with Chiklis and thinking, like, this is just like high school.
I have no idea.
Man, I would watch that buddy cop movie.
Yeah, yeah.
We're in Utah.
The Commish.
Chiklis, we're in Utah. We're here.
And the Shield, I think, was his big.
Oh, the
real
Shield.
Big
right. The Shield. The Commish.
That was maybe after that.
Yes.
Maybe
yes.
You gave him the idea for that. I don't know. That was
the Commish, I think, was probably like, to be honest with you, I didn't see either one of those shows. But my sense was the Commish was like the family version and the Shield got darker, sort of. But
yeah. you were too busy watching Della Ventura to catch up on the Commish.
You know, that was the heyday of Della Ventura, too. I mean,
yeah.
Do you remember? We didn't know each other at that time.
That was just prior to our fateful meeting. Yeah.
Was I still talking about Della Ventura at that time? Probably.
I can't remember. It's definitely come up once or twice in the intervening years, I can tell you that.
Oh, yeah, of course. Now, so Matthew, 2019, I mean, it seems to me like this has been one of the best years of your life. Wouldn't you say?
I mean, yeah, hard to argue. I was doing the work that I love to do. That includes teaching senior citizens about the dark side of humanity through independent and foreign films. Having a very
enriching and sort of challenging in the best way possible, a personal life with two dogs and a partner whom I love very much. We also both got to work on this amazing film, Mary and I, upstate all summer long, and the film got into Sundance, and now I'm talking to you. So, I mean, put all that together, and I mean, can't think of anything better than that, except getting the Palme d'Or at Cannes, but you know.
Right, Palme d'Or at Cannes, and it does feel like, to a certain extent, the energy and the excitement around your eBay store has sort of diminished a little bit, but that seems like...
There may be an inverse relationship between professional success and eBay sales, which I'll have to live with somehow, but you know, I wouldn't say it went completely away. There's been some drips and drabs all through. I'm still maintaining my high seller rating. I mean, and to be honest, the worst part about having worked on this film for the past 6 months is that I only saw about 100 movies this year, and this was a great year for movies, and so my movie-going time took a little bit of a hit, but, you know.
100 movies. What is your average year in terms of movie consumption? Like, I don't know that I've ever actually asked you that or been aware of a specific number, but now that you mention it, like, It seems something that is just almost completely obvious that all you do is watch movies. Not, I'm not saying all you do, but I mean, I'm like you
I mean,
are.
I wish that was all I could do. I have to pay the rent somehow. But the great thing is that website that I know I've dropped a few times here, letterbox.com. If you want to go find me, I'm Langdon Boom there on Letterbox. You can post a link on the webpage. But that is, since that's come out, it's allowed me to transcribe all the movies I've seen since I think 1995 when I was making just a diary of them. And so you can just go and look and just see kind of like by year. And, you know.
All right, well, do me a favor. Just tell me what the number is. I mean, just tell me what the number is.
Oh, yeah, you could also just tell Sam the number, but I forgot what Letterboxd is. Sounds interesting.
Oh, well, this year, the only number I can tell you right now is this year I saw 100 films. Like, as of right now, there's still like a week to go. So, but I think the previous year maybe was a little bit higher, maybe closer to 200. But
that's double.
Listen, it went down since my heyday years.
Oh yeah. Okay.
What do you buy the notion though that movies are over and we're in the television era? That's like a cliche I've been hearing for 10 years.
I mean, I will just say this: like I'm Matthew the film guy, not the Matthew the TV guy. So that always will be where my heart is. But yeah, I watch a lot of TV, episodic TV, these long sort of bingeable shows, and there are some filmmakers who have gone into the TV game that are making as good a work or better than they ever did as filmmakers. So I think even Brad Anderson, I can't remember exactly what he's worked on, but he's had that like a renaissance in his career from being able to work on these kind of HBO shows and whatnot. So,
Brad has done a bunch of TV directing but also film. He had a film that came out. Was it Beirut? One that he did recently. And he's always like often like, I don't know.
Yeah, he
Estonia
does his own thing. But the TV,
like
the renaissance of this TV that Michael alluded to allows some of these artists who otherwise maybe some of their commercial venues have dried up a little bit to keep working and to be able to make some of their own personal films.
Did you like what Scorsese said about the Marvel movies?
I mean, it's hard to disagree with him about that. It's just, look, I love The Irishman. I got to go see it on Broadway, and it was like a wonderful like capstone to his entire filmmaking career. So it's like, for a filmmaker who like influenced me to really want to be a director, like it's very hard to argue with his wisdom and his insight into that. Having said that, I enjoy the odd superhero smashing up a city movie as well. And I just hope that the commercial prospects of those movies don't crowd out his kind of movie. And that's his whole point. Not that you shouldn't enjoy a mindless superhero movie once in a while, but that it's going to, we need to champion these smaller movies or else they just won't get made. Because when even Scorsese can't get his gangster movie made, it's not a good thing for movie in general.
Yeah, that's a little bit scary. But, you know, these things ebb and flow to a certain extent, right?
Yeah, I think so. And look, not to say, like, you know, be self-aggrandizing, but when a movie like Black Bear gets made, you know, it's on the strength of a couple people, actors like Aubrey Plaza and Chris Abbott, who, you know, have somewhat of a cachet, not enough to make $100 million.
Aubrey Plaza was in Parks and Rec, right?
Oh, yes, she was in Parks and Rec. I don't know if you've ever seen that, Sam. But yeah, from that, she's able to parlay that cachet to making a less than 100% blockbuster type movie. And as long as that's still a viable option, I think good movies will still be getting made. It just so happens that some of the best movies I saw this year were just not American movies. And that, I think, reflects the values that other cultures are putting on their arts compared to us.
Okay. And I was thinking about Scorsese. Yeah, that's great. Was it Scorsese or Coppola that said that who predicted what was going to happen with
Coppola.
The video? Okay. With the video camera.
Coppola.
Okay.
And that totally came true in a weird way.
Well, Coppola, if I'm not mistaken, said, you know, we're going to have like teenagers making the next great American movie because of the video technology. And on some level, yeah. I think what the part that he missed was like YouTube on some level. But that concept of, I mean, it would be interesting to go back to like the aughts and just think about, you know, as digital was changing and as like, you know, we were moving from film to video and all those technologies were unrolling out, there was a lot of predicting as to what would happen. And weirdly, a lot of it came true, because usually that stuff never comes true, but it did come true.
Yeah, he kind of nailed that one. But you're right that the YouTube thing and the kind of coincidental like narrowing of the length of these things. Like, yeah, I think part of what Scorsese is also lamenting is that like our attention span has just gotten shorter and shorter and shorter and shorter, which is, I guess, why he made a 3.5 hour movie or whatever it is, a 3 hour movie
to punish everybody.
And it's got a kind of, you know, it's good news, bad news. Like everyone can make a YouTube video, but it's actually really hard. The medium is the message in a lot of ways to sustain the tension. So that kind of colors what kind of content actually comes out of that. So
I'm sorry, did you say everybody can do a YouTube video? Is that what you said?
Yeah, just like you're doing.
Right. Okay. Just wanted to make sure you said that.
Yeah, everyone, you know, and you can...
A lot
you know,
of movies you're, get into Sundance.
Good as anybody. Tonight,
I should tell you. I said a lot of movies get into Sundance, so...
Yeah, yeah, at least like 100 out of, I think, I don't know, several thousand that get submitted. So, yeah, you know, it's not none. I
mean, how many YouTube shows get views?
Yeah, well, that's the other thing. It's also signal-to-noise ratio, and it's just like a fire hose of stuff coming at you, and everyone has to scrap for attention, and that also changes what you do.
Okay, that's very nice, young man. Can we watch When Harry Met Sally now, please?
Yeah, you know, actually what I've been doing in my class lately is trying to catch up on some of the directors who have been some of the more well-known Sundance kind of celebrities or sort of made their names that way, and to get ready to see some of their newest films. And, you know, it's been hit or miss. Sometimes those movies try even the patience of the most sort of adventurous senior citizens. But there is still an audience for this kind of movie. If you, I don't know, if it's in a class setting, you have a friend or a trusted celebrity or semi-intelligent person on a podcast kind of point you in a certain direction. So, you know, I'm not completely despondent about the current state of film.
All right. Good to hear it. Now, let's cut to the quick. I am going to be on vacation for, 8 working days. Eight
that's
glorious
oh, that's
working
so good.
Days. I got, you know, like I got The Watchmen on my list. People say that good things about that show and other shows, Succession. I feel like I get to catch up on that.
You
thing.
Gotta watch Succession.
Succession is actually, I thought the first season was very uneven. And the second season, to me, it shot off. It's
okay, no spoiler okay. alerts around here.
So what happened in the last episode?
I can tell you that Mary is like a huge fan of Succession and has said it's like about as good as anything that television has
Whoa!
Made. She's like calling it like Shakespearean. So I have that on my list when I eventually have time
oh,
too.
Yeah.
So
major schadenfreude for the ruling class watching Succession.
So, okay, this is good. So, but... Matthew, what should I watch? What should I watch? What should everyone watch during this time when they're sitting around with their family? What do you recommend we watch?
Right,
and you can even say two things if you want, or three.
Yeah, I got two movies, both of which I just showed to my senior citizens class that went over well. The first is a film that's basically like a compendium film. It's like nine short films that sort of in some ways interconnect, but not really, not in sort of like that
Matthew,
way.
I'm sorry, Matthew. I apologize. Are they at a point yet where they call you on your BS, where they're like, well, I understand it's Norwegian and it's about incest, but really it's about consumerism. Can we watch something pleasant, please?
Yes. Oh, yeah. Afterwards, at the end, I get a lot of them come up to me and goes, you know, this discussions are always very interesting, but can we watch something nice?
No, but they also get the, like, you know, like, yes, I understand. It's a time travel. Like, they're absorbing your lessons.
Oh, yeah. No, they're
totally
in my class,
fed up.
They're self-selected as very, very sophisticated film viewers. So sometimes they have. In fact, last week about this film, the one I'm about to recommend, so someone definitely challenged me on sort of my interpretation of something. And they said it is like, you know, you're young, so you took it this way. But I think in all experience, and I was like, hey, maybe so. You know, it's a give and a take when it's a real, class situation.
Hmm.
So, yeah, that does happen. And, Michael, you should audit my class sometime. Come
I would
on
love
by.
To.
Sit in.
I
show
to.
Great movies, and the,
honestly,
and the conversation is just worth the admission alone.
I would love to.
Which is free.
Where is this class
so,
again?
What's that?
Where is this class again? Because I will totally go.
It's at the Forest Hills YWNYHC. YM and YWHA. It used to be the JCC. They lost the franchise, whatever. It's a Y. Central Queens. It's in Forest Hills.
I'm so there.
So everybody within the sound of my
voice.
Wait
a second. It used to be
welcome.
A Jewish community center, and now it's a Christian community center?
No. It's the Young Men and Young Women's Hebrew Academy or association, so there's no C in it.
Off-brand bullshit
need,
is that?
Wait a second. I was going to say, like, you need to get, like, accredited to be a JCC?
Oh, yeah. It's a national organization, and you got to pay fees or dues or whatever.
You are going to pay fees and dues for JCC?
I don't give a damn. I'll put JCC right up on this door. What are they going to do? Are they going to sue me?
I mean, if I tell on you, maybe they will, but I won't. Don't worry, you're safe with me.
Yeah, I don't want to be associated with that. They do very hostile interviews, and I've heard them all criticize Israel.
Exactly. Oh, man. Well, anyway, last week I showed a movie by a filmmaker named Rodrigo Garcia. I don't know if you guys know who he is. He's also done a lot of TV. He did a particular show that I actually didn't get to see, but was like his own creation called In Treatment. But I know him from his independent films, and he's actually the son of the Colombian author, Gabriel Garcia Marquez.
Oh,
so
wow.
He's kind of got like, huh?
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Yeah. And his movies, like, they don't quite have that sort of, like, magical realism that his dad was known for, but occasionally there's a touch of it. And he's really, like, one of these really just mature, insightful, into human nature kind of directors that isn't making huge movies with giant plot points, but, you know, very sort of quotidian small stories. And this one is actually, it's called Nine Lives. And it is actually nine short films about nine different women, which is also interesting. He wrote and directed this movie where all the protagonists are women. And in various sort of, I don't know what you call it, existential struggles. And it kind of takes you through younger issues, through older issues, towards like end-of-life issues. And occasionally you'll see some repeatable characters come in and out of it. But it's just really great. It kind of forces you to kind of switch perspectives, like you're not necessarily on their side or not, which is kind of my favorite kind of movie where it's not very black and white, the sort of morality of things. And it's just really just like a challenging but touching movie. And it went over huge with the senior citizens, I can tell you that, but not because it was some sort of a pandering kind of a confection. It was actually a very deep movie. And Garcia's new movie is actually premiering at Sundance next month, so I hope to be able to catch that.
Great. Okay. Rodrigo Garcia.
And can I just say, Rodrigo Garcia is adapting, it looks like, adapting his dad's 100 Years of Solitude for Netflix.
Ooh.
Oh, no shit. Oh.
Yeah.
Wow.
That sounds great.
Wow. Well, that it feels like his whole career. This just did magical realism, now bankable.
All right. Well, they're good. I'm glad.
But also, you know, all his other movies are great.
Suddenly,
too.
The teacher becomes
looking
the
at
student.
Her is great. Sorry.
Go ahead.
What's that?
I said, suddenly the teacher becomes the student.
Oh, yeah. Listen, Sam, I go into every educational interaction with a beginner's mind. You know, that's mm-hmm. the secret of my success. Okay. I don't know anything.
There you go.
But the other movie I wanted to drop real quick is by another filmmaker, a female filmmaker who's also a visual artist and a singer and a songwriter. I don't know if you've ever heard of her. Her name is Miranda July. She kind of has a bit of a sort of a indie celebrity around her, too.
Queen of Twee.
Okay, yes. Now, I normally am not sort of a fond of the twee, but her first film, which, and I hadn't seen any of her films, which is why I showed this to my class the other week. Her first film, Me and You and Everyone We Know, definitely the first third, you're just like, I am in twee hell. This is the tweeest twee that ever tweeted.
Wait, what does that mean, twee?
It's just like precious and sweet, but like kind of like diminutive.
Where have I seen
some,
this before? Is she a comedian?
Cutesy hipster BS.
Is this a little Wes Anderson-y?
She's not a comedian.
She in L.A.?
I imagine
no. Well, actually, maybe she is.
I feel like she belongs in Portland. She seems like the most Portland person to have ever lived.
Does she do like little short sketches?
Sketches? I'm not sure. She's done like museum installations, and like part of her movie is like a critique of like the curation kind of ecosystem and the museums and the people who run them. So it's a more art world kind of stuff.
I think
that
that's maybe where I've seen her work.
She probably has an MFA in something, you know, like that. But
she's like if Yoko Ono were like a hipster woman child kindergarten teacher or something.
Yeah, I guess so. And that's why I really did not want to watch this movie for like the first third of it. But guess what?
Brendan doesn't like that description of her. I should just tell you, he thinks she's more talented than that.
The First Bad Man isn't a terrible novel either.
I think Yoko Ono is super talented.
I think Yoko Ono rules.
Yoko Ono's?
Yoko Ono's.
yeah, I like all Yoko Ono's, 1 through 5. But to me, the movie wins you over because even though the sort of the conveyance is in this sort of indie super hipster kind of indie sort of twee mode, by the time you get to the moment where the 5-year-old kid is on the internet in a sex chat room, like exchanging lines about poop with someone he doesn't know, it's like it's investigating the sort of internet in a way. And this movie came out in 2005. So I think it was really prescient about the way that sort of the fire hose of information and availability is corrupting our innocence as a people. So it actually kind of takes that idea of being twee and being innocent and really like runs it through the mill. Like it's drags it through the mud in a way.
And I think it's
like a really important thing.
Everyone We Know, is that the name of
me
it?
Me and You and Everyone We Know.
You and Everyone We Know.
You come away thinking like maybe kids talking to adults about sex in chat rooms is good, actually. Maybe it's precious and sweet and adorable.
Yeah, it has a kind of really ambivalent kind of take on it. I mean, it definitely touches on some dark things like the pedophilia and the really like lack of a parental oversight and, you know, just like adults who do not know how to be adults and all that kind of stuff. But in a way that I think, you know, it's just like this movie has a lot of ideas that are thrown at you about a lot of different things. And I don't think it's reductive.
You know what Brendan just said?
I missed it.
Sounds like boring Todd Solondz.
I mean, it's way deeper than Todd Solondz. It's not boring.
Guns Damn. Up.
Whoa.
And I actually was a PA on Happiness, so I should have an emotional connection to that movie, but I don't. It's shocking. He's like, you know, he's like twee Howard Stern, basically.
I will say the first one, possibility I'll see 9 Lives. The second one, I will probably be rewatching Coming to America.
Wait, so what movie are you recommending?
Well, that's never a bad idea.
Recommending Me and You and Everyone We Know, or is there a new one?
That's it?
No, I'm definitely recommending Me and You and Everyone We Know. There is a new one. It's not out yet. It's going to premiere at Sundance, so I'm just kind of getting on the Miranda July train a little bit to just kind of see what's what before I see her new one.
I guess she
has another one called The Future, which I haven't seen, but I'm definitely interested in seeing it. I mean, again, I totally get the kind of prejudge kind of harshness on a movie that I described, but that's why I think it's so worth going to see because it definitely wins you over.
I will say I went through a Miranda July phase at college when I was going through a very tough breakup. So some of my dislike of Miranda July now is probably really directed at my former self.
Interesting.
All right. Well, you should forgive your former self. Maybe there's something there.
For
you
being
don't know.
So weak and having so many feelings.
No, feelings are fine. Feelings are fine. Even the twee ones.
In
fine.
A certain sense.
Matthew Film Guy.
What about The Irishman? That was great, right?
I love The Irishman. Sure, it was amazing. If it's the last film that Scorsese makes, he went out on top. It's like the capstone to all the themes that he explored throughout his other great films. Mean Streets, Goodfellas, Raging Bull, Taxi Driver. It feels like the last 45 minutes of that movie make it a masterpiece. Up until then, it was like a good exercise in what he does. But the way he kind of added that sort of coda about him being old, not to spoil anything, really put it above and beyond for me.
And the aging stuff was intentional. I just wanted to say that. I don't know. I thought it was pretty amazing. And in some ways,
I wasn't bothered by any of that aging stuff.
I thought it was intentional. And I just want to say, too, without overstretching it, the politics are pretty good in that movie in a way that is not forced or preachy.
Oh, yeah. No,
I was super impressed.
It's not rose-colored, but it's also really like, yeah, you're like, yeah, unions, MF-er.
Speaking of politics, what about Parasite? I would assume that would be extremely your shit.
Well, it is still on my short list, so I have not yet gotten to that. But I love the South Korean films. Hong Sang-soo has become my new favorite filmmaker. And Bong Joon-ho's Okja, which I recommended before in this show, is one of my favorites. So I've definitely got Parasite on my short list. It could be one of the next movies I see, but unfortunately,
it's
haven't seen it yet.
So good. And it has the best politics, and Bong Joon-ho is amazing. And you introduced me to him when you told me to watch Okja, so thank you.
Nice. Thanks for that. I'm glad to do some good here. Sam?
Film Guy Matthew.
You should see it too.
What?
I'm saying you should see some of the films I recommend too.
Someday I will. Someday I will. But I will tell you that my appreciation for you extends beyond watching a film here or there or not watching a film ever that you recommend, although I have watched multiple ones that you've recommended, which is a good thing.
I'm going to eat apples and watch Dirty Harry, so sorry.
That's actually...
Doesn't sound bad, right?
Doesn't sound bad. But Matthew Film Guy... Thank you, not just for coming on in 2019, but in coming on in 2018 and 17 and 16 and 15 and 14. And I'm very grateful as we enter the second decade of my knowledge of you as a person. We're almost coming close to our 20th anniversary of knowing each other.
Is that like the paper anniversary? What is it? What do I get you? I don't know.
Well, I mean, maybe let's not go overboard, so that way neither one of us is too committed to having to go out and shop. Matthew, Film Guy,
weighted blanket. Yeah.
I'm so glad that your film got into Sundance. I am looking forward to it winning the Sundance d'Or or whatever the award is there. I can't remember which
sure
one.
Will.
I did not win. And I hope you win it. I know this is just the beginning for you. At one point, you'll probably feel like I don't have the time to go on that show anymore. I'm no longer, just the Majority Report's Matthew Film Guy. I'm everyone's Matthew Film Guy.
Like Matthew Film Guy's like, I'm sorry, Sam. I'm actually negotiating getting funding for a new film about criticizing capitalism through the medium of incest. And I'm negotiating with an Armenian arms dealer.
Right.
on the French Riviera.
I'm not saying that definitely won't happen, but let's just say I look forward to that being a problem I have to contend.
Isn't that going
to
be awesome? Well, you get money from like Emirati arms dealers to make your movies that like defend human emotion or whatever, Matthew?
I mean,
that's what I'm picturing for you.
In mise-en-scène is.
Right there, boom. Well done. Touche. Matthew, I hope that when you do go to Cannes with your film, that you will choose to bring me as part of your crew there. And we can hit the nightlife and the
blackjack table.
Whatever it is where everybody hangs out in Cannes. That would be great. But in the meantime, Matthew Filmby, have a happy holiday and happy new year, same to Mary.
Thank you so much, Sam. Same to you, all you guys there. Take it easy. Talk to you in 2020.
See you in 2020. All right. Matthew Film Guy, ladies and gentlemen. There he goes.
Man, 2020 is going to be a big year.
2020 is going to be nuts.
Everyone go see Parasite. Don't read anything about it. Just go see it. You'll thank me later.
Is it in the theaters?
I think I buy it?
Can I see it online?
I don't know.
I think it's still in the theaters, I thought. Yeah, I feel like everything is all mashed up now.
I mean, you can definitely pirate it online if you want to.
I'm not. I would never.
I feel like Parasite? The filmmaker wouldn't care.
Parasite is
Yeah, it's so good.
Okay. Got that one down there. All right, let's do a couple of clips. I mean, well, Freebie Friday, right? I mean, what the hey? It's going to be a long show, folks, but you'll have a week and a half to enjoy
it. Yeah, this one's got to last you a while.
It sure does. Let's do this just to. It's been a while since I've had a debate with a libertarian, and I don't know where this cropped up in my thing, and I don't know why we haven't heard from this guy ever. He seems to be super confident about about his ideology, and he has his own show, and apparently his guru is Walter Block, and Walter Block, of course, has been a guest on this program at least two times, right? Maybe three, but and he seems to be. It's a fascinating rant because, and I must warn you, there are expletives, because we know that libertarians are rebels. They swear a lot. But what's fascinating about this rant is it is, he is both sort of like completely sure of his position, denigrating of those who disagree with it. And offering absolutely no substance whatsoever. And so I am going to dispose with his argument rather quickly after he, to the extent that he makes it, and then say, anytime you'd like to come on and have a larger discussion about it, welcome to do that in 2020.
I want to point out that this is how Eric July clipped this himself.
Eric July himself clipped this. Yes. Okay. And this is the name, and he has a YouTube show?
Maybe Twitch.
A Twitch show? Is it a Twitch show? Okay.
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
And he seems to be a huge fan of comics. Cool. I mean, I'm just watching from his thing. And
surprising for a libertarian.
Is that? No. Mm. Okay. Yeah, no, right. Okay, I get it.
Bunch of friggin' nerds.
Maturity.
Here it is. Here he is making the case that if you bring up the most obvious argument, then that is remedial in his mind.
All right, man, this should go without saying. It should, but unfortunately, you fucking level one rookie bitch-ass commentators on Twitter, I don't understand it. You not fooling a libertarian by bringing up them bitch-ass roles. How many times is it that we say we oppose taxation, and the first goddamn level one rookie, childish, kindergarten-ass, bitch-made argument that you throw out there is, what about the roads? You must drive on the roads. You must hate the roads. You think we ain't fit of all the things that could stump libertarians, which tend to be smarter people. They tend to get there by way of economic reasons. And you somehow think that the thing that's going to stump us and be like, damn, fuck this libertarian shit, is the motherfucking roads. Jesus Christ. Walter Block has a long form write-up of the privatization of roads and highways. This is level one shit. Just because maybe you can't figure it out, which is okay. This is why we're for free markets. It's because you can't figure out how, minus taxation, people would say, damn, I need to get over there. What if we built a goddamn flat space? If you think people can't figure that shit out, Well, you can't figure out how people would do that, so you. That's okay. This is why we're free markets. Let the smart people kind of figure that shit out and allocate those resources. But I promise you, homies, you're not fooling now libertarian by bringing up them bitch-ass roads. Fuck them hoe-ass roads, man.
Well,
wow, libertarians really hate roads.
They really, really do hate roads. And but here's,
if Trump gets reelected, now, I'm going to become a libertarian.
I have, I've interviewed Walter Block multiple occasions, and people can go back and make their own assessments as to Walter, the soundness of Walter Block's arguments. Mr. July, he doesn't offer any. He just says it's very remedial. Now, I don't think the idea is that we're trying to fool libertarians by bringing up roads. It is incredibly fundamental and rudimentary in many respects, because you walk out of your house and you see a road, and you say to yourself, how did it get there? Now, I believe that Mr. July thinks that, well, making a road is easy, and it is to a certain extent. It's not a horribly complicated physics problem on how to make a road. And in fact, we all have, not all, but many, many of us Americans have a relationship with private roads. And for the most part, we call them driveways. And everyone can figure out how we make a driveway. But the point is, the driveway does lead to a road. And for those of us who have spent some time living in rural areas, on dirt roads, and then have actually watched the process of these roads over time maybe becoming paved, we understand why some roads would never, ever get built. Because when Mr. July is talking about the allocation of resources, he is saying that the smart people will allocate resources in a way, and they will. But the smart people, as he calls them, which I would suggest in a libertarian world would be defined by something like how much money is in your bank account. That's an indication of how smart you are. The smart people would only build roads that benefit them. And now that benefit could be broader than just, I need a road to my house and my gated community with my paramilitary that's there waiting for me. It could also be like, I need a road for the serfs so that they can bring me, tribute or grains, whatever it is. But what of the serfs that live too far? Or what of the serfs who are saying, I don't want to give you grains? I just want to live my life here. But of course, I need access to other people on some level. I mean, that's the whole point. We could privatize the post office. We could privatize the road system. The road system, but I think it's undeniable. And even someone as mentally challenged as myself, in talking to Mr. July,
to bitch ass arguments,
yes,
ho ass,
for ho ass roads, which you're obsessed.
Someone
with.
For me who has an affinity for the B asterisk 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 A asterisk asterisk roads. I would say that it's undeniable that we would have fewer roads. Now, maybe that would be a good thing, but it wouldn't necessarily be a public policy decision. If it was based upon private funding, it would only benefit those people with money. And the same with the post office. You're from North Dakota, correct, Matt?
That's correct. Yep.
There's really no reason for us to have postal service to North Dakota, I think, largely speaking. And in many areas, I would imagine it's fairly remote, but they, short of Indian reservations, there's postal service that is relatively convenient to all of you. Maybe you got to go down to the local post office. But you know what? If I had to allocate resources in a way that was just about pure market efficiency, probably not.
I'll say getting deliveries is more dependable in my hometown than it is in Brooklyn sometimes.
Well, I mean...
that does not surprise me because nobody has a buzzer.
Well, the point being that smart people, and I don't know how he's defining smart people, would allocate resources only in a way that benefits them. And they would determine benefit not based upon things like a civic society or providing the most opportunity to as many people, but it would be rather, how can I accrue more than those around me, thereby increasing my purchasing power, my power, broadly speaking, in society. And so those bitch-ass roads, what they indicate, and the reason why they are one of the first things that come up is because it basically is a perfect manifestation of a value system that says we want to include everyone in society, that everyone in some way has the capacity and the ability to contribute to society, even if they're not doing so at that very moment, and that everyone should in some way, because of the social contract that we have, everyone should enjoy at least a basic minimum. And we argue over what the basic minimum is. Of the output of society. And that's why. And that's why it comes up first. But just because it comes up first doesn't mean we're trying to fool anybody. It's just that libertarians have a very difficult time to answer it. And I don't care if Walter Block has written an entire book on it. I've spent a decent amount of time talking to Walter Block. And, you know,
and
I got
to
say,
then they can go to a fifth court, and then you flip a coin on the seventh
court. But I want to make
this time we've lowered the age of consent.
I want to remind, this is just a periodic reminder, end of the year 2019, if you're a libertarian and you want to discuss any of this or any other issues, you can call in at 646-257-3920, or you can tweet at us, and we will always endeavor to have you on the program and discuss those topics. And you can start by telling me what kind of libertarian you are and how there's no other libertarians that know what they're talking about. And then we can take it from there.
Some libertarians think this and this. Isn't it a problem for you, Sam, though, that potholes have been extinct for a year and a half? Don't you remember? I mean, nobody's seen a pothole for a year and a half.
Oh, boom. Oh yes, we did. There you go. Potholes have gone away.
So when you read the Domino's example, I think you realize that your obsession with ho-ass roads have been revealed as another liberal totalitarian boondoggle.
The end. Yes.
Just for the record, libertarian socialists are really good at roads.
What is going on with Rudy Giuliani now? Oh, okay. All right. Well, let's do a couple of these, and then we'll go back to the debate. There was a couple other things about the debate that we should probably talk about, but this is crazy. So Rudy Giuliani, I mean, there's definitely some internal strum and drang. I don't know how you say that. In the Trump administration. And there is a feeling that Rudy is like, he's half playing for the president and half playing for himself at this point. And to some respect, like, that is the beauty of the conservative movement. Yeah. At the end of the day, they're all playing for themselves on some level.
It's about the individual.
And they are fortunate in that they all share an agenda of, like, just fleecing as many people as possible and increasing their wealth. And so there's less discord. You know, they are pursuing what our libertarian friends would say, you know, like a pursuit of our own self-interest. And I think to a certain extent, the reason why libertarians think that the pursuit of self-interest will necessarily be a benefit for society writ large is because they are because when they hang out with like-minded people, they're all on the same page, which is just, I'm just going to make myself as wealthy as possible. And there's no other values that are existing, which is also why you know, broadly speaking, there are exceptions. Mr. July is one of those. Why they share such similar attributes in terms of where they are and sit in society relative to race or gender. But here is a Rudy Giuliani. He is speaking with Turning Points USA because, you know, Charlie Kirk wants to get in on this as well. And he is basically laying the groundwork. We are 11 months out now from the election. And this is like a twofold insurance policy, I think, that Rudy Giuliani has. One is, I'm providing an insurance policy for the president. What are we going to do if we lose the election? And two is, I'm providing an insurance policy for myself. What am I going to do if the president turns on me?
This is America. You know where that happens? That happens in countries where there are dictatorships. And they're moving us in that direction. The whole impeachment process just trashed the Constitution. No right to counsel, no right to call witnesses, no right of confrontation, no right to even have your lawyer there and investigate all the lawyers.
Pause it.
They want to put bar.
For 1 second. Now, first off, they're moving towards dictatorship. The congressional dictatorship you rarely see. It's usually invested in one person who is at the top of. But. And this is the big talking point, that there is no opportunity for the president to call witnesses or to meet his accusers or whatever it is. And of course, it is Mitch McConnell who is preventing that right now in the Senate. In fact, Nancy Pelosi feels so strongly that President Trump should have the opportunity to defend himself that she's withholding the articles of impeachment to allow them the opportunity. Now, maybe Rudy Giuliani hasn't gotten the message yet. Maybe he can't hear it. This guy's turning into Mr. Magoo very quickly.
No right to even have your lawyer there and investigate all the lawyers. They want to put Barr in prison and they want to execute me. Good luck, by the way. The mafia tried that. And the FARC. The mafia, the FARC, and the word you can't say, Islamic extremist terrorists, have all taken out contracts of one kind or another to kill me. And my answer is, good luck. I just get angrier and I go after you more.
And you,
so
sir,
they can investigate
you're a pretender.
I'm a big fan of the FARC. I just, apropos of nothing, right. I just would like to have that out on the public record.
I would like to see the contract that was put out on Rudy Giuliani by Islamic, extreme Islamic terrorists or whatever he calls them. And frankly, I would also like to see a little bit more digging around on the mafia's contract on him, because I would imagine there might be one by one group that we would call the mafia. But I suspect that there might be other groups that are also maybe not so concerned with getting rid of
sort of like
different
like,
kinds of contracts.
You mean like maybe there was a contract from the Medellin cartel to assassinate General Noriega if they thought he was skimming, but maybe there was another different organization that provided him security.
Exactly. I mean,
just different contracts.
Right.
There's just different relationships with different groups. Maybe as an example, you build a whole career based on destroying one type of mafia that you might even be ethnically identified with, just at exactly the same time that it opens up the door for another type of mafia to dominate New York City. And literally every day in the news, we hear about you having different potential and alleged bizarre relationships with that other mafia.
Das Vidania.
Isn't this kind of what The Irishman is about?
And yeah.
Do terrorists really put out contracts on
That's
people?
What I was saying. Like,
I feel
like
they don't really do a lot of outsourcing.
That's right.
Let's put a contract on him. He'll use it in a TPA speech and make an ass of himself. First of all,
what do we got, Ben Shapiro?
Women should cover. And second, we want a contract on Rudy Giuliani. Can I? But I also, the only serious point I make is that all right wing politics is projection, and that's what they're trying to do.
Yeah,
and that's like a serious point.
So Ben Shapiro, he of the he is sort of like the self-appointed Pope of the Jews. Right?
We could do a lot better than that.
He's young,
yes,
Jew Pope.
Yes.
He is.
Well, he's the young Jew Pope.
Don't speak to me in a familiar way.
He thinks that he has the ability in his really bizarre form of Judaism that he can determine who is a good Jew and a bad Jew. He said this many, many times before.
He's used the phrase gyno.
And,
Jew in name only.
Jew in name only. But he's also said that, you know, you're a bad Jew if you support Democrats. And which, you know, you'd have to dig pretty deep into to the teachings at Yavne to find that. But it's there.
So the majority of American Jews are bad.
Right. Exactly. As Rabbi Akiva said. But even Rabbi Akiva was not the Pope of the Jews like Ben Shapiro is. But Ben now is going to explain to us the prominence of the fetus and how the fetus is far more relevant than a fully born woman who, of course,
fucking A,
just comes from the rib of Adam anyways. So
Michelle Wolf championing the abortion. I mean, this is a shift in the language, in the tone, in the tenor of left. And then you wonder why evangelical Christians support President Trump. You don't have to like President Trump's treatment of women. You don't have to like the fact that he says nasty things about people. You don't have to like a lot of things about the dude. But if the alternative is a Democratic Party that thinks that that is funny, a Democratic Party and an entire political wing of the United States that cheers and laughs when a human being says about the killing of an unborn human being that that killing made her feel powerful like God, like that's... I will vote for pretty much anything before I vote for anybody who laughs at that joke. I mean, that, like, really. I'll vote for pretty much, and evangelical Christians feel the same. See, what the left wants to do is say you have no moral standards if you vote for President Trump because President Trump is a bad man who's done bad things. Okay, well, then what does it make you to vote for people who want abortion on demand all the way up to point of birth and who refuse to even acknowledge the humanity of a baby 5 seconds before it comes through a mother's vaginal canal? And you're going to have to explain that one to me. Which is more immoral? Voting for a president who has allegedly sexually harassed women or voting for somebody who has pledged to make abortion on demand not only legal across the country, but celebrated in our culture? Which seems worse in terms of politics? I'm not talking about who you'd rather have babysit your kid. I'm not talking about who you'd rather go to dinner with. I'm talking about the fundamental principles at stake when you talk about partisan politics. In an environment like this, an environment this polarized, this is why, unless the Democrats were willing to push forward an impeachment that was actually supportable by facts, unless they were willing to push forward an impeachment that was so overwhelming in its criminal standards of proof, this was going nowhere from the outset. Because if you think that anyone is going to go along with the Michelle Wolf wing simply because President Trump doesn't know how to talk on phone calls and says dumb crap a lot, you are thinking about this thing all wrong.
All right.
What is this kid talking?
Let me explain. Let me translate.
Out of your mouth, Ben Shapiro.
Let me translate. Ben Shapiro saw a skit by Michelle Wolf, who is a comedian, and wherein she was saying that she was empowered by having the ability to have an abortion, and therefore, there's no way Republicans are going to vote in the Senate for impeachment because of the Michelle Wolf wing of the Democratic Party, or as we refer to it here, is the primary Democratic caucus.
That's right. I mean, is this a new genre of triggering the cons?
Exactly.
What the hell?
Well, first off, there's no one who's saying like abortion on demand 5 seconds before birth. That is not the case. It is not available to anyone. In the only instance where you would have any type of abortion, even remotely close to the end of a term of pregnancy, would have to do with a life-threatening situation for the mother.
I changed my mind. 5 seconds before birth.
Right, exactly. I've carried it 8 months, and now it's like, I'm just going to do this because Michelle Wolf told me to do it.
Did you hear about the Elizabeth Warren psych bill?
Right.
And then you say, psych to the kid. 5 seconds away, you go, gosh darn it, I'm aborting you, even though you're about to come out of the vaginal canal. Because I thought that would trigger Ben Shapiro.
But the idea that that a fetus, and he wants to call it an unborn human being, well, I mean, it's a fetus. There's actually like a, you know, it's about facts, not your emotions, not your feelings about it. It's simply about a fact, Ben. And, but the idea that he would just blow off the notion of like, okay, he's been alleged to have molested 43 women. What possible impact could that have on our politics? The idea, like, because it's also, let's be clear. If you look at the Republicans in the Senate and the House of Representatives, I don't know that there's anybody in this room who has been alive at a time where there has been less female representation in the Republican Party. Never mind white people, the exclusive representation near exclusive. I think it's probably, 3% of the electeds in the House might be African-American, black.
Among the Republicans?
Like, maybe less.
I think it's less.
Well, it could be less. I mean, Heard, he's going to retiring.
Mia Love or Mia Long lost her seat. Mia Love gave me no love.
No love.
Lost her seat. That's how I remember.
Tim
Scott in the Senate.
Nevertheless, the idea that the president having total disregard for women so much so that he feels that he can grope them because he can get away with any of it. His total disregard then becomes the justification for anything that Donald Trump does. So in other words, there is nothing. There is no position a Republican president can take. There is nothing a Republican. He could shoot somebody on Fifth Avenue. If you are in any way surprised because you have comedians making rude jokes about abortion, that's why Donald Trump should be allowed to do anything. So he basically, and he's also saying like in the political world, he has taken this comedian who's been elected by no one and put them into politics in his regard because he wants the broader culture to be defined by who we elect as a president, as opposed to keeping it about rights. I mean, this guy talks about it's about facts and not feelings. His entire project is about feelings. His entire
self-victimology and self-justification. And I also think that it is interesting to me that he did not say, like, he downgraded it. He didn't say allegations of being a rapist. Like, even there, that's a word choice, you know.
Of course.
Yeah, he chickened out.
Of course. Well, yeah, why not go full boat? I want to know exactly what they would, what Ben Shapiro, the Pope of the Jews, Popes of the Good Jews, thinks is okay and inexcusable if you have people like this comedian Michelle Wolf around. Like, what
the
are
little
they
Jew kid said that I could nuke Mongolia because she made a very bad joke.
Very bad joke.
And it was very rude and it was terrible and we're nuking Mongolia.
And that's what's at stakes with our partisan politics.
Yeah, I mean, this is so frustrating to me because I do think, like, Doug Lane, who's, you know, Disclosure is my publisher, but like I agree with him. He's somebody on the left who takes, you know, free speech, you want to call it. That's another word that's been destroyed by these people extremely seriously. And I've migrated much closer to that position. But like this idiot constantly making disingenuous, whiny claims about this and then literally is not only endorsing cancel culture over comedy, but extending it to a blank check to support a president doing literally anything because of a joke. I mean,
cancel culture for thee, not for me.
But it's beyond cancel culture. That's not even, I mean, that is literally, I couldn't even think of it's like, well, I heard, you know, I don't know, Nick DiPaolo made a joke, so I give myself permission to do hit and runs in Westchester.
That's right. If Nick DiPaolo is making these kinds of jokes, And we should definitely be locking up Bill Barr and executing Rudy Giuliani.
Exactly, that's it.
As a political program. Yeah.
You know, you may not like that the FARC have a hit on Rudy Giuliani, but Nick DiPaolo mocking a black activist that was killed, all bets are off. Okay? The FARC can do whatever they want.
Fast and Furious would be a big problem under Obama. if Nick DiPaolo or that Norton guy hadn't made such rude jokes.
Yeah. Exactly. Norton's still on Sirius. And anyways, my point is
that
all firstborn white males need to be castrated.
That Series 24, that's why Benghazi's okay. Because they're putting out TV shows and doing that show like 24.
Right.
So Benghazi...
You know what? Keith or Sutherland, they think torturing terrorist suspects is a joke. And you know what? You might not like that the intelligence officers in Benghazi were killed, but guess what? All bets are off.
Forget
24
it.
Was super offensive. You may have thought 9/11 was bad, but Rambo was super in bad taste.
That's right.
About Afghanistan.
Absolutely.
That's what he's saying.
I was just going to go out on a limb and say that Ben Shapiro doesn't need jokes to oppose abortion. God, it is funny to look at, to watch him grasping for more and more cultural pegs. As
right.
It were.
Oh, exactly.
It's you're totally right. But this is all that, you know, he's like the millennial moral scold. And I think in 2016, like he did a whole like, and if this was also hilarious because he literally said like Andrew Breitbart would never do this. I mean, Andrew Breitbart would be having, I don't want to say it because it's disgusting, but Andrew Breitbart would have been ecstatic about Donald Trump. So that was – it was ridiculous. But he did leave Breitbart and say Bannon was bad and all this stuff. And he – I don't know if he was a never-Trumper, but I think he might have been like a – I live in – he might have even been like a I live in California. I'm going to cast a protest vote guy. And so it's more subtle than Beck because Beck has a down market and he just needed to drop all of that crap if he wanted his career to survive. But Shapiro also needs to be a Trumpist to have a mainstream
right.
appeal.
Of
so,
course.
But he's got to always find, like, still some... do this like, well, I still object because right. of course I'm super moralistic.
Donald Trump is horrible. However, right. Michelle Wolf making these jokes is just a little bit more horrible enough to get me to the place where I need to be.
Well... It is a thought process that a lot of evangelical Christian voters go through. Like, they are disgusted by Trump and the rape stuff and the swears and his rudeness and crudeness. But if you really believe abortion is murder and that's, like, your first priority, then you're going to vote for him.
I would also, though, argue that none of them would have ever heard of Michelle Wolf were it not for Ben Shapiro.
Yeah, no disrespect to Michelle Wolf. She's a very funny, talented person. But, I have not heard... I think she was on Rogan a couple of months ago, and I knew that because it was a suggested YouTube video that I didn't click on. No offense to anybody.
Yeah. Also, I think a lot of evangelicals do not care even remotely. They're more like Kenny McBride than like actual pious
right.
people.
Right. I think that's
fair. All right. Kevin McBride.
Let's just play this clip Powers. From this guy. Is he still? Oh, he's a Daily Wire host, right? This guy, Michael Knowles. Ooh.
Oh, how dare
wow.
you?
Wow.
How you come
Dude's
near
taking...
my brand with your trash.
So,
I'll sue everybody.
This, but unironically.
Now, I swear to God, imagine if I bankrupt
this guy
the Daily
is
Wire
the...
over a petty IP dispute.
This guy is the comedian on, right? He's the comedian. He's the funny one.
I think so. I think
on the Daily Wire. So it's fun guy. To tune in every now and then just to find out what these guys are convinced is funny. And here it is. This is the comic stylings of Michael Knowles.
They did it. The Democrats have impeached President Trump. So what happens now? At this point, I'm actually half hoping that the Senate convicts just so that President Pence can then institute a full-on Handmaid's Tale-style dystopian Puritan tyranny. Not because anybody wants that to happen, least of all Mike Pence, but just because it would totally own the libs. Can you imagine how hilarious that would be? I mean, it would be dystopian, obviously, but it would be absolutely hilarious. They think they impeach Trump, and they think, because they've never read the Constitution, that that means that now Hillary Clinton is going to be president. And then just peeking out from behind the curtain is Mike Pence there, just passing out bonnets left and right. That would make it almost all worthwhile, though I say almost, because this actually is sort of a sad thing.
All right, pause it for 1 second. I just want to get this. Like, I listen. You know, nobody likes it when you deconstruct a joke, and nobody likes it when you have to explain a joke that's not funny. But
it's a tiny bit funny.
Well, I don't understand the concept of why would Mike Pence do this if he didn't want to do it?
Because
why couldn't Donald Trump
even,
just do it?
He can't even. Right. Well, good point. But I think that he can. But actually, look, I can't even go there. I just need to make a serious point because I found that so disgusting and offensive. And I can no longer condemn the terrorist that shot Steve Scalise in the hip.
because
following Ben Shapiro's logic, that joke about terrorizing half of the population in a sci-fi dystopia.
If you actually laugh at that and you think that's funny,
you think that's funny? I can't say that going to a baseball field is wrong.
Right.
I can't. You might think it's stupid crap to do, and I do, but I can't condemn it.
All right, I want to see this. This is Michael Knowles' acting reel. Just let's see this baby.
And you're an actor. You're acting, huh?
Holy shit.
What the fuck, Nicole?
It's not what you think.
Not what I think. Are you fucking your brother?
No!
I wish I could do that.
What? Oh, I like it when you're rough with me, pretty lady. Hmm?
No,
oh, that does not mean anything, okay?
Sometimes I wish the elderly would just die.
Great stunt work.
Quit it! This is some serious shit! You're fucking right, serious shit!
God, he's mad.
I'm gonna do fucking worse than that.
Is that a threat? That's a promise, sucker.
What are you gonna say? You have an incest with your sister.
I'm adopted, remember?
That makes it better.
Baritenor, I damn near killed her. Who is she? It's like a stock joke.
Guys, shut the fuck up.
Guys, we're all there.
Fuck. God,
all right, this is a little longer than I was hoping it would be.
I mean, look, we get it.
Some fine work.
All right, I'm just going to take some IMs today. We're going to wrap up in about 20 minutes. We got a couple more clips to go through the debate, but we don't have time for calls, and I don't want to. I feel bad ending 2019 with people on, 40 people on hold. So we'll do IMs only. Tom Cat, hi guys. Even though I'm really feeling bad after the disastrous UK election, I'm inspired to continue the fight for a left Britain. Tonight, I'm at a local momentum meeting to decide what we're going to do over the coming weeks and months. It's obvious we need a well-supported, connected, left, independent media base in the world, but especially the UK. If anyone fancies doing an MR-type show or podcast over here, I have a music tech production qualification can be used. Just saying, anyway, Merry Christmas, and thank you for all you do. Do people come into contact with shows like that, like YouTubers in Britain?
I mean,
like an MR of UK.
Novara Media does some very good work.
Yeah, but I don't think they're not. As far as I know, their video product isn't at our level. I mean, there's like that Leading Britain's Conversation thing that like had a whole bunch, like from Owen Jones to Nigel Farage. But
I gotta really recommend. I know it's different, but I really, honestly, Tribune is really, really good. It is written, but that's something I would definitely join.
Is that the one that Jacobin bought?
Yes. I mean, because Jacobin has also been extremely important with the formation of all this stuff here. But I think there does need to be a lot more of that type of thing in the UK.
There needs to be some cross-pollination. Like we had on Aaron Bastani from Novara Media on the Intifada a little bit ago, and I would like to do more of that kind of thing.
Rick from Florida. I have always been puzzled by Tulsi's support, so I decided to look at the coverage of her on various independent left-wing YouTube shows. Naturally, I started with the leader of the Dumb Dumb Left, Jimmy Dore, and to nobody's surprise, he has almost 60 videos on her where she is supposedly destroying her critics or being smeared by the media, and literally every title is meant to signal positive vibes about Tulsi in some way or another. Went to check his latest videos, assuming he would have one defending her abstaining on the impeachment vote, and somehow got her to come on his show for an interview to explain her stance.
I feel proud of myself about that.
Keep in mind, this is a presidential candidate, and this is 2 days after her controversial decision. To me, that says everything you need to know about her. I mean,
I'm suspect of that. This is that to me, this is red flaggy all over the place.
Indeed.
Don't be a hater.
Is there a list of Matthew's film recommendations somewhere? Yes. Letterboxd. We'll put a link in today's description. Chrissy Boy, we're organizing a Casserolazo, a.k.a. a noise demonstration here in OKC. What is that? Oklahoma City. If y'all could shout it out, conditions in the Oklahoma County Jail are horrific and the sheriff is cooperating with ICE. Oklahoma City DSA will be co-sponsors of the event. Any interested Okies would like to reach out for more info January 1st at Oklahoma County Jail. So check out the Oklahoma City DSA. Screaming Into the Void movie recommendation, The Report, streaming on Prime. Listen to Jeremy Scahill's intercepted interview with the real Dan Jones, who led the Senate investigation in the CIA torture, a.k.a. enhanced interrogation.
Amazing episode.
Goth Koala. Sam, last night while you were watching Pete doing his stage moves, you told the crew to remind you to do a comedy bit you used to do in the 90s. What was your bit? Oh, yeah, okay. This is my... do we have anything of Pete? Do we have anything else, Pete, or no?
We have Bernie dunking on him.
Let's do Bernie dunking on
him. That will inspire.
This is three, and then it gets to Bernie dunking on him later, so...
Okay.
Pete, I apologize. I'm going to be dunking on you as well.
All right, so this is from the debate last night. We'll start with Warren and Buttigieg having at it over closed-door fundraising. And I think, like, the net of this is a negative for Buttigieg, in part because in the broader context of the evening, it was just one more instance where people were signaling that they don't like Pete Buttigieg on the stage, and I think that gets communicated to people. There is a substantive critique that Buttigieg makes of Warren, which is that while she has said she will do no big donor fundraisers in the Democratic primary for president, she did raise such money in her senatorial campaign and moved it over about $10 million, in my understanding, over from that war chest into her presidential campaign. Now, I think the biggest problem with this in my mind is just that, like, it's hard to, you know, get a lot of mileage out of that when you have done that. I don't know that there's anything
just going for
wrong with that per se. I don't know who those donors were, in particular, but it's just it's a hard road to hoe, as it were. But Buttigieg, I think, like I say, in the end comes off the worst in this because of not just this moment, but because it's consistent with a lot of moments over the course of the debate.
And everybody gets one vote. But here's the thing. People who can put down $5,000 to have a picture taken don't have the same priorities as people who are struggling with student loan debt or are struggling to pay off medical debt. I'm running a campaign where people whose voices get heard. We can't have,
thank you, Senator Warren.
We can't have people who can put down $5,000 for a check, drown out the voices of everyone else.
Thank you, Senator
they
Warren.
They don't in my campaign, and they
Mayor
won't
Buttigieg.
In my White House.
Mayor Buttigieg, you had your hand raised. Well, can't help but feel that might have been directed at me. And here's the thing.
Pause it. This is a problem for Pete Buttigieg, because... if someone just randomly says, or just in general says, and maybe it was directed at him, but she, for the vast majority of people out there watching this, I don't think they thought it was necessarily directed at him. But when somebody says, hey, money corrupts, and if you're taking money from millionaires and billionaires, it's corruptive of you. And particularly,
sounds like you're talking about me.
And he goes, that was obviously about me.
Oh, why would you think that?
Yeah, exactly. Here.
And here's the thing. We're in the fight of our lives right now. Donald Trump and his allies have made it abundantly clear that they will stop at nothing. Not even foreign interference to hold on to power. They've already put together more than $300 million. This is our chance. This is our only chance to defeat Donald Trump. And we shouldn't try to do it with one hand tied behind our back. The way we're going to win is to bring everybody to our side in this fight. If that means that you're a grad student digging deep to go online to PeteForAmerica.com and chip in 10 bucks, that's great. And if you can drop $1,000 without blinking, that's great too. We need everybody's help in this fight. I'm not going to turn away anyone who wants to help us defeat Donald Trump. We need Democrats who've been with us all along, yes, but we also need independents worried about the direction of the country. If you were a Republican, disgusted with what's going on in your own party, we're not going to agree on everything, but we need you in this fight, and I will welcome you to our side.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Senator Warren, 45 seconds to respond.
So the mayor just recently had a fundraiser that was held in a wine cave full of crystals and served $900 a bottle wine. Think about who comes to that.
Look at it. He had promised
that every fundraiser he would do would be open door, but this one was closed door. We made the decision many years ago that people in smoke-filled rooms would not pick the next president of the United States. Billionaires in wine caves should not pick the next president of the United States.
Mr. Mayor, your response. You know, according to Forbes magazine, I am literally the only person on this stage who's not a millionaire or a billionaire.
Pause it for 1 second. Now, we should also add that he is on stage with at least half the people who are twice his age. And if there is any doubt that this guy is going to be a millionaire in 10, 20 years, or, you know, then I would eat my hat.
Bullshit. I was eating compost when I was your age, young man.
It's true, actually.
Yeah, well, also, he was arguing a second ago that we shouldn't give free college to the children of billionaires. And now he's saying that he is the class background of his current net worth and not that of his parents. So, like, which is it, Pete?
Right. That's a good point.
So if this is important, this is the problem with issuing purity tests you cannot yourself pass. If I pledge never to be in the company of a progressive Democratic donor, I couldn't be up here. Senator, your net worth is 100 times mine. Now, supposing that you went home feeling the holiday spirit, I know this isn't likely, but stay with me, and decided to go on to PeteForAmerica.com and give the maximum allowable by law, $2,800. Would that pollute my campaign because it came from a wealthy person? No, I would be glad to have that support.
Pause it one more second. The issue isn't that people went online and donated $2,800. I don't think anybody would really take much of an issue with that. The issue is that they're in a wine cave that you're actually selling them, literally selling them access. That's the issue.
Access to the wine cave.
In fact, you know, like the real reform should be like, we only accept donations online and we have no contact with donors. Or we have no private contact. I mean, that's really the issue. I mean, that's why they won't open up the
That's why he won't open up the fundraisers. Can I just say really quick, though, stylistically, I think, unfortunately, among some people, that kind of argument works. Like, that's sort of like, well, how could you say that? Because you're rich yourself, blah, blah, blah. So that's a decent direction tactically for him to go in, of which he totally spoils by just that dickish digression.
Yeah, he can't.
I have no idea why he would do. Yeah,
say that thing about like you not have holiday spirit.
It's
weird.
Like, I think it's actually a maturity thing.
Yeah, it's totally.
I think part of it is also that there's probably the in there. You know, when they sit down with the Facebook people that advise his campaign, they probably also say like, "Oh, you also got to show you're tough, and that you can dish it out in the way that you can take it."
The support from everybody who is committed to helping us defeat Donald Trump.
Rudy.
We would like to bring in everyone, but obviously, Senator Warren, I'd like to give you a chance to respond.
I do not sell access to my time. I don't do call time with millionaires and billionaires.
Sorry, as of when, Senator?
I don't meet behind closed doors with big dollar donors. And look, I've taken one that ought to be an easy step for everyone here. I've said to anyone who wants to donate to me, if you want to donate to me, that's fine. But don't come around later expecting to be named ambassador, because that's what goes on in these high dollar fundraisers. I said no, and I asked everybody on this stage to join me. This ought to be an easy step. And here's the problem. If you can't stand up and take the steps that are relatively easy, can't stand up to the wealthy and well-connected when it's relatively easy, when you're a candidate, then how can the American people believe you're going to stand up to the wealthy and well-connected when you're president and it's really hard?
Judy.
Senator, I've got to respond. Mr. Mayor, we're going to give you one more chance to respond. If you can't say no to a donor, then you have no business running for office in the first place. But also, Senator, your presidential campaign right now, as we speak, is funded in part by money you transferred, having raised it at those exact same big-ticket fundraisers you now denounce. Did it corrupt you, Senator? Of course not. So to denounce the same kind of fundraising guidelines that President Obama went by, that Speaker Pelosi goes by, that you yourself went by until not long ago, in order to build the Democratic Party and build a campaign ready for the fight of our lives, these purity
fight
tests shrink the stakes of the most important election.
Judy.
We'd like to bring everyone in. We'd like to bring everyone in.
Okay, now, if I was Warren and I was going to pursue this, I would have probably appreciated that Buttigieg may go there. And I think I would have probably used that last, and it's very easy to sit here in this, completely non-pressured environment and say this. But this is, part of what her campaign should be preparing her for. And look, this is, again, why in certain circumstances, things are just easier for Bernie, because he has had the exact same basically through line his entire career. He hasn't done anything different. She should have taken the opportunity, realized, gotten sort of a whiff, particularly after he said, since when, Senator, and gotten the idea like, okay, I see where he's going here. She should have said, look, when I was senator, earlier in my career, I did some of these things. And I raised a little bit of money. We've transferred it into our presidential fund. But I realize how corrupting it is.
Because I was late to this in life. I became a senator because I was really, it was an academic and then an activist.
Right.
I wasn't planning on doing this since I was a child.
You build in the critique. You say, I learned. That's one of the benefits of my experience.
Right.
But to go out on your first presidential campaign and have them own you from the beginning of your career because, you're not running for mayor of South Bend, this is where.
Oh, and incidentally, why are all of your fundraising records under lock and key
right.
from your time as the mayor of a college town?
Right. I mean, this is, I think sometimes, and this is what was so impressive, and I think we have this clip of Bernie about Afghanistan.
Yep, we must. That was amazing.
Later, we may play this, but Bernie was called on his vote for the war in Afghanistan. And he just came out and said, yeah, I made a mistake. I have total respect for Barbara Lee, who made the right call. I made the wrong call. And I've learned my lesson. And so instead of it being a liability, it becomes a strength.
Yeah.
I've learned from my mistakes.
And that literally never happens in this kind of setting.
Absolutely not. But it also, what it projects is it projects a lot of confidence. And it's much better for you to bring up the critique or at least address it in real time than to allow your opponent to do it. Here is Bernie Sanders doing exactly that. He is owning the critique, accepting it, and basically saying this is an argument for the positions I have now are informed by the mistakes I've made before. Who doesn't appreciate that?
Sanders, you do often point to your vote against the war in Iraq as evidence
of your judgment on foreign policy, but you did vote for the war in Afghanistan. And as recently as 2015, you said you supported a continued U.S. troop presence there. Was that support a mistake?
Well, only one person, my good friend Barbara Lee, was right on that issue. She was the only person in the House to vote against the war in Afghanistan. She was right. I was wrong. So was everybody else in the House. But to answer your question, I don't think you do what Trump does and make foreign policy decisions based on a tweet at 3 a.m. in the morning or desert your longtime allies like the Kurds. I think you work with the international community. You remove all troops over a period of time, a short period of time, within 1 year.
I mean, that is the way that you deal with mistakes in your record. And, you know, every single person up there has those. Obviously, the longer you have been in the Senate or the House, the more you have, I would imagine, just statistically speaking. And that's one of the problems with Biden. Joe Biden will not acknowledge a single thing that he has ever done wrong in any context. He will not acknowledge that he screwed over Anita Hill. He will not acknowledge that there were three women who were he would not allow to testify in those hearings against Clarence Thomas that would have corroborated at least the behavior of Clarence Thomas. He will not acknowledge his failures on the bankruptcy bill. He will not acknowledge his failures on the war in Iraq. He will not on and on and on and on. He will not acknowledge. All right, let's play this clip. This is Bernie Sanders. This is sort of the follow-up to the clip where Warren and Buttigieg get into it about these closed-door fundraisers, where Buttigieg is basically selling his access. And I think Warren was trying earlier, you know, throughout the debate to sort of draw a distinction that she doesn't sell access. She gives selfies for free. But I just don't think people are savvy enough to know how that works with fundraisers and what she's trying to draw there. I think it's actually a good mechanism, but they didn't do a good job of communicating what it is because it assumes that we have this knowledge.
Came off like a big humble brag.
Well, it came off as a humble brag, but it also didn't make sense because, I mean, frankly, like I'm savvy about this stuff and I didn't know that that's the parallel she was drawing. But this works really well for Sanders because this is, again, a moment where he shows he's trying to show it was clear Sanders was trying to show that he has a bit of a sense of humor. And it's a little bit self-deprecating in that he acknowledges Pete Buttigieg is the youngest person in the on the stage and that, you know, some people have some concerns with Bernie's age. But he manages to work that in. This is a pretty good exchange where Sanders is talking about billionaire supporters.
Senator Sanders, I am rather proud. Maybe, I don't know, the only candidate up here doesn't have any billionaire contributions. But you know what I do have? We have received more contributions from more individuals than any candidate in the history of the United States of America at this point in an election, averaging $18 apiece. Now, there's a real competition going on up here. My good friend Joe, and he is a good friend, he's received contributions from 44 billionaires. Pete, on the other hand, is trailing, Pete. You only got 39 billionaires contributing. So, Pete, we look forward to you. I know you're an energetic guy and a competitive guy to see if you could take on Joe on that issue. But what is not a laughing matter, my friends, this is why three people own more wealth than the bottom half. This is why Amazon and other major corporations pay zero in federal taxes.
There you go. I mean, that
was great.
Well done.
Joe and Pete were so flat-footed that he was going that, yep. like they as quantitative on their
Yeah,
ass.
They were not ready for that. But Joe, like, I mean, honestly, I really do think the Joe of 2000, I see it as decline. I think if you go back and look even just for a few minutes at him debate Ryan, and Paul it's Ryan. Totally depressing because the, you know, how, or actually, no, it's encouraging. Politics have opened up a lot since then.
Yeah.
But the Joe Biden of 2012 would have, you know, he totally would have been like, hey, you're a good friend, you know, too, even if you're saying malarkey or whatever.
Right,
like,
right, exactly.
The, literally to like lit the, be there and be like, yeah, right.
Yeah.
Jerk.
Yeah.
Like,
right.
Pete Buttigieg knew that he needed to laugh at that, whereas Joe Biden just went immediately to, like, why I oughta.
Joe immediately went to, how can I lie about this?
Right, exactly. I'm going to need to cover on this.
He was like, I thought when they did the bingo cards with me, it was less billionaires.
All right, here is the bit that I used to do I don't know how many times I did it, but back in the early 90s, based upon, I think it was the 92 campaign. I think it was probably based upon Bill Clinton.
Sounds
now that
right.
I think about it. And because Clinton was the one where it became very clear that this is something that you use. Now, Buttigieg knows that this has become too clear that somebody's doing this. And so he does this, where he's clear not to point, because they tell you not to point to people. And one of the things I did back when I was in comedy, I would travel around the entire country. And I would meet people. People like Mary Smith, who was a nurse. And she came to me and she said, Sam, I don't know how I'm going to cope. She said, I've got 3 kids. I'm a nurse. I don't know how I'm going to put food on their table. I don't know how I'm going to pay for their health care. Every day is just a challenge to stay optimistic. And I looked at her right in the eyes and I said, Mary, I hear you. I don't care. I'm just a comedian. It's not my job.
That actually would be very like, and I said, I don't care. I'm just trying to fulfill a lifelong child ambition of being president.
It's just been my ambition.
That would be that's
to
what,
be president.
Right. That's what Pete should say. Yeah. That'd be very transparent.
But I mean, that like it is so, he is so plastic. And I think my sense is you just don't have to be that. You just don't have to be that savvy about this stuff to pick it up.
No, and I don't think so at all.
Even if you're not, I think the idea that everybody seems to hate him around them is just like one more sort of like, I would think in the next couple of debates, it's going to be this dude's going to be the Ted Cruz of,
I think you're right. And I think
of 2019.
I think it's very interesting because everybody has, you know, there's personality preferences. Obviously, there's ideology. But you're at a point, I mean, I'll take the one, you know, obviously Klobuchar and Biden, right? Just, you know, on a policy level. But they are actual human beings, whatever else you think. I mean, I don't know. Buttigieg, or frankly, I mean, I feel bad. You know, Beto compared to Buttigieg. I think Beto at least is like a mammal.
He's got a certain pathos to him, as does Amy Klobuchar.
I want to play one more clip. I think it's Biden, how he explained with the GOP because he was lying here. But and then we'll read a couple IMs and we'll get out of here. One thing that did occur to me is that when Bernie was saying that, though, to Biden and to Buttigieg about I'm the only one up here who hasn't taken any billionaire money. I Steyer would have been like, well, no billionaires have given
money to me. Like no one ever gave me money, Larry.
I mean, on some level, I think Steyer probably, it would not surprise me if Steyer was like the one guy up there, like his billionaires are like, get the I'm not going to give you any money. I know how much money you got, dude. You don't need my money.
Word.
I don't think has he even taken any money? He's just spent his own money.
Oh, yeah, I think he's... Well, no.
He's gotten people in there, but that was just because he was mining for emails. Right. But here is Joe Biden, and there was a moment where Bernie Sanders is asked about the lack of diversity on the stage. And Bernie answered this question. It was one that came right after the last question that he had was about climate change. And Bernie was making the point that climate change, the first victims of climate change are almost always, not almost always, I mean, we know that this is going to happen, are going to be people of color are going to be the most marginalized in society. And the idea was, like, the question is, like, what, you know, what do we lose by not having diversity on the stage? And what we lose by not having diversity on the stage is perspectives that make people aware of the implications of other things that they don't necessarily realize how they impact people of color. And I do think that, you know, I think that Bernie can speak about these issues in a more expansive way. But the fact of the matter is that unless you've had some, you know, firsthand experience of it, it's less likely, it's not impossible, but it's less likely that you're going to have a perspective about how people who are different than you experience different things, right? Like, I mean, you know, we talk about the 1950s was the heyday for the great compression where we, you know, and, but the fact of the matter is if you were, you know, a black guy or a black woman living in just about everywhere in this country, the 50s are not such a great time for you. I mean, we talk about Social Security kept 2/3 of people out of poverty. But the fact of the matter is if you were a farm worker, a Latino farm worker or a black man working on a farm or a black woman working as a domestic worker, you're not covered by Social Security. And certainly nobody's talking about that. Nobody's talking, they're not writing, you know, they're not big thought pieces at the time about that because nobody, you don't have access. So Sanders started to answer with climate change. Let's play this clip. This is a different one. This is number two. Sanders started to answer in this way. And it was the only time we saw a moderator really basically say you didn't answer the question. And maybe there might have been one other time where that happened, but we never saw it within 20 seconds of them opening their mouth.
And a whole entire reparations answer from Joe Biden where he didn't, I don't think he even used the
word
reparations.
Listen, Pete Buttigieg did not answer three or four questions and was not asked afterwards or before or during or whatnot. But this is sort of interesting because, I mean, you could take issue with Sanders' answer, but you got to let him at least answer. It's not like you're waiting that long. You only get 75 seconds to answer.
Tonight.
Thank you, Mr. Yang. Senator Sanders, I do want to put the same question to you, Senator Sanders. What message do you think?
I'll answer that question, but I wanted to get back to the issue of climate change for a moment because I do believe this is the existential issue.
Senator, with all respect, this question is about race. Can you answer the question as it was asked?
This audience sucks. Awful.
Because people of color, in fact, are going to be the people suffering most if we do not deal with climate change. And by the way, we have an obligation up here, if there are not any of our African-American brothers and sisters up here, to speak about an economy in which African-Americans are exploited, where black women die three times at higher rates than white women, where we have a criminal justice system which is racist and broken, disproportionately made up of African-Americans and Latinos and Native Americans who are in jail. So we need an economy that focuses on the needs of oppressed, exploited people, and that is the African-American community.
I mean, I'm not sure, you know, where Bernie was going by bringing it back to climate change. But it appears that he was talking about, you know, the perspective on how the people of color are going to be most victimized by this. I mean, I think his language on this still can improve, frankly. And I think, you know, he sees the way essentially that politics function in this country as being, you know, that the economy is inherently political. And I just don't know that, which I think is the case. I just don't know that the broad swaths of American people fully understand that.
Well,
in
he
terms
has to make
that
case. I mean, I just want to take a really quick point. I do like what Breonna Joy Gray tweeted, which is, don't go for a cheap dunk if you're not prepared to hear facts. Climate change is a racial justice issue, which I thought was a very good response to that. But the other thing that the other two things, though, is I would go from both directions in a way, if you wanted to really tease out the critique. So one, I think there is obviously a conventional centrist or whatever that is purely representational in the sense of the Adolf Reed critique, right? Which is that if the only choices in the world are between white supremacy capitalism and diverse capitalism, obviously we pick diverse capitalism. But we don't want a world where there are that levels of obscene inequality and exploitation. And basically what the framework of some of these questions are simply who is just on the stage versus what their policy set is. And I think while that's valid, that does need to be pushed back on. On the flip side, where I'd actually criticize Sanders, and this is more subtle, is I think part of the expression of that question and that focus, again, shows that you can't make essentialist claims about any community, period, because I think a lot of that interest comes from, as an example, people from, at least in my experience, like the African-American professional upper middle class who are not oppressed in the economy the way Sanders is talking about, but do face obviously racial discrimination.
Right.
So I actually think that I have a problem on both sides of it, because I have a problem with representation at the expense of politics and policy and the way it's always weaponized against Sanders. So I will always push back against that. But I actually think for Sanders to tease it out, he has to do a twofold track of doing some of the things you're talking about in terms of getting more specific. But then on the other hand, making those unitary economic arguments while also recognizing that, in fact, the upper class is not nearly diverse at all, but there is some diversity to it. And that is what is expressed
right
in those questions.
Right. That's why I would like him to have said at one point, not necessarily the economy, but society.
Right.
And
right.
I mean, it's a small, you know, it's like these are small tweaks. And I think it's a function of just sort of like, I think both in practice and probably in terms of just actual like lived commitment, I think that his commitment to racial justice is, at least with the people on the stage as it is now, frankly, is probably unparalleled.
I mean, of course. And people try
like,
to.
I don't think there's anybody else there, frankly, was arrested in protesting, racial injustice. I don't think there was anybody else there. You know, we're looking at this sort of lily white short of Yang experience. And I don't know what his experience was in terms of racial justice. But I mean, Bernie has that track record. I think he just needs to learn to express it in a way that is broader.
And as Cornel West said, commitment is more important than the buzzwords.
I agree.
And,
I think that that's not necessarily for
but again, he's winning. He's winning.
I mean,
he's got the best.
I
want to just say again, just because we have to do this as just our public service. I mean, Pete Buttigieg literally put out a list of fake endorsements. Joe Biden has been on the other side of actual civil rights policy questions. You know, so you know, and. Yeah, I won't include the other one, but it's just to me, I don't know why. I mean, we all know why Bernie always gets those questions.
And the framing of that question tells you all you need to know about the political stance of the moderators and where they're coming from. They care way more about the politics of elite representation than they care about the worst effects of white supremacy and racial capitalism, which are material and can be measured in suffering and death. So maybe Bernie isn't always nuanced enough in the way he talks about this stuff, but you really cannot de-link one thing from the other. And I think in general, his campaign has been very good about having an intersectional analysis that always centers class.
Right. But I'm suggesting that, you know, that there may be moments where centering class is probably not the most effective thing in terms of what he's facing. I mean, I understand there's a different agenda, but I'm interested in getting him elected. And I think that like, you can making that small tweak, which I think is probably hard for him, because he's had a lifelong commitment to that dynamic, but making a small rhetorical tweak, and he's certainly come a long way from where he was in 2016, without a doubt, I think is also, it's still, you know, on the list of things to do thing.
And some of this recalibrates.
Let's play
general.
This. I want to see this clip of Van Jones going after Warren on this. What is this?
We have to think purity tests. That resonates with me.
Yeah.
I do feel that there's something beginning to happen in the party where you've got to be pure on every issue. You've got to be above. And a lot of people start feeling left out and excluded by your kind of populism, which can sometimes sound elitist. Does that make sense to you?
So now what Van Jones has said, and he's talking about purity tests, the idea that you won't meet with billionaires and millionaires in a wine cave. It's a little bit elitist.
Is that actually what he's saying?
Yes. Because it was purity test that Pete Buttigieg came up with. The idea that you won't meet with them is a little bit elitist. Why do you think you're so much better than all of us? I mean, this is unbelievable when you think about, like, and Van Jones, I'm sorry.
Wow.
Been not a fan for an extended period of time.
Wow.
I had him on once. In fact, I would encourage people to go back to that. I remember where I did it in my basement back before we would even do any video. And I interviewed him, and it was so stunning to me. He was starting a movement to fight back against the Tea Party. And he was going to fight back about the, you know, against like wealth inequality. And I was like,
sounds
so
good.
Who's responsible for this? Like, who's the enemy? I may have used those words or something to that effect. Said, oh, there isn't one. And I'm like, well, but I don't understand. Is this like the weather? Like, are you fighting against the weather? Like, there's no, it was completely, the whole thing was as if this stuff had happened passively. Like there's no power that is causing this. It's just like the weather. And we just need to build better umbrellas or something to that effect.
That's right.
All right. We've got to wrap this up for 2019. I'm going to read 5 IMs, 10 IMs, and then we'll wrap it up here. Hugo 420. Did Matthew Film Guy ever make the Cernovich documentary? Destiny called Michael a piece of shit over his Buttigieg criticism.
Whoa.
He's a star for attention, I think.
Oh!
Wow. Well, I can imagine
what he's going to say about me after today.
Parliamentary cricket enthusiastic. A highly recommended reading on the history of impeachment in Britain. We've been doing impeachment since the 14th century. That petulant child, Donald, really ought to be thankful. Removal from office over here used to involve the big burly man with a sharp axe. Connecticut comrade, California local labor push, MR crew. My friend has asked me to help publicize his push for 2 important pro-labor reforms to his assemblyman, Jesse Gabriel, for the 2020 California legislative agenda. My friend is DSA member, board of directors, a member of West Hills Neighborhood Council that is trying to push through 2 separate statutory amendments to California Labor Code. 1 is just cause, 2 is required salary range disclosures, all jobs posted online. He said he could really use more local support or DSA members at the meetings where he presents these pros. His Twitter handle is @time_progress. Boomer Sam, I need to spend my Christmas catching up on Parks and Rec so I can stay hip with the kids' references these days. Why don't they sell Cliff Notes on these darn shows? Happy holidays. Sudolis, Sam, let's get pedantic about the calendar. Functionally, every time keeping device in use today around the world uses the date representation that starts at year 0. ISO 86101 is the international standard by every electronic device, every digital, I don't care.
Come on, guys.
Champagne Communist. Samantha, have you ever heard about Spygate 2.0, the new cheating scandal regarding the New England Patriots video? Shut up. Pitch ass road. Ben Shapiro is wrong. We don't want just abortion on demand. We also want abortion DVR. Jalaya. Hey, Sam, you have.
Now he's going to need to vote for Trump.
Hey, Sam, you have big dick energy. Oh, thank you for right here. Yeah, we need to go.
We need to leave.
Come on, guys.
Chattiest Stevens, a decade can be any 10-year span you want. Every passing moment is the end of a decade. Jay Chivone, best wishes to everyone in the studio for a healthy and happy new year. Also, I'm buying everyone an abortion.
Well, thank you.
Thanks.
And we will take, I'm going to take one final IM. of the year, ladies and gentlemen.
You're actually getting gifted it. Thank you.
Christo, by all means, debate Mr. July. How about Miranda July? Thanks for another great year. Happy holidays, MR. Left is best. Folks, thank you so much for everything in 2019. Michael, Jamie, Matt, Brendan, Josh. thank you so much for making this year so great and all the support you've given this show. We will see you in 2020. Michael has a show on Monday.
Monday.
Check out TMBS and, of course, the Antifada. You can find it on Patreon.
That's right.
And Literary Hangover.
New up tomorrow.
New tomorrow. So you check it out. We will be doing the AM Quickie every day, more or less most of the days during vacation. So you can check that out at amquickie.com. We will be back live on January 2nd. Have a Merry Christmas. Have a Happy Hanukkah. Have a Happy New Year. Have a Solstice Day. Happy Holidays.
All that stuff.
See you next year.
It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm going to get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught. Between the truth and the light bulb, but finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in, and my pilot light shining bright. I get somewhere the choice was made. For the option where you don't get paid. For the road that bends before it finally breaks you. I guess somehow I lost my drive.